good girl. We'll get out of this yet.
What a team, she replied dryly.
Chapter 12. 5 p.m. The dark current swept around his legs and the alligator welcomed it. The pulsing water had started to rise only a short time before. First, just a film creeping across the rocky floor of the tunnel, then a succession of gradually higher waves. Now the water lapped around his belly, a quartet of small eddies tugging at his legs where the haunches creased into his armored sides. The alligator's tail swung back and forth, ponderously, impatiently. He wanted the water to float him away from the hard floor and to give him the buoyancy he needed for true swimming. The water meant freedom. But the level rose no further, and so the alligator plodded on. Various objects, chunks of a variety of substances, nudged against him. He nuzzled some of them with his snout before they were swept away in the current. The scents were largely unpleasant. There was nothing there worth devouring. Lumps of something soft batted against him and were gone. He briefly detected meat, but it was carrion, and he had no taste for that now. Instead of snapping up the ragged object, the alligator forged on. Something alive and delectable still lay ahead of him. He knew that, and, knowing it, forced his nearly insatiable hunger into abeyance. Under his feet, through his ears and nostrils, through the very wave action of the current, he could feel the pulse of the city. Now it beat in time with his own body. He ignored the slight pain in his belly. It was as nothing compared to his appetite. Ahead and behind, the dark tunnel stretched on forever.
He had been trying to reach Tachyon for 2 hours now, and Hiram was growing concerned. Everyone agreed that the little alien had left Jet Boy's tomb soon after completing his speech, in the company of an attractive black woman. But where had they gone? His home phone did not answer, and down at the Jokertown clinic, Troll insisted that he hadn't seen the doctor all day. Tachyon was probably out somewhere drinking, but where? Hiram had called all of his usual haunts one after the other, had even tried Freakers and the Chaos Club and the Twisted Dragon, on the off chance that the Takesian might have decided to drown his guilt on unfamiliar turf. No one had seen Tachyon since the early afternoon, when he left the ceremonies at the tomb. Fortunato might not have cared, but Hiram was growing concerned. Had the astronomer already gotten to Tachyon? Was there another name to add to the list of the dead? There was a tightness in the pit of his stomach that no amount of food would cure. Restless, uneasy, unhappy, Hiram Worcester got to his feet and strode out into his restaurant. The doors would be opening in less than 2 hours. Nearly every ace who counted would be arriving, and he devoutly hoped that Dr. Tachyon would be among them. By then, the worst would be over. Even the astronomer was not insane enough to attack the kind of power that would be assembled at Aces High in 2 more hours. Hiram strode to the long, curving bar. The wood gleamed, and the mirror was spotless and brilliant with reflected light. A quartet of bartenders in sky-blue shirts were tapping into fresh kegs of Guinness Stout, New Amsterdam, and Amstel Light. Modular Man was way down on the last stool, drinking a rusty nail. The android liked to experiment. "I detect no sign of any hostile presence," Modman said. Hiram nodded absently. "Keep watching," he said. He headed for the kitchen with long, light strides, still thinking about Tachyon. He must be at home. Nothing else made sense. But if he were home, why not answer his phone? "Because he was dead," whispered some dark part of Hiram's brain, and he could almost see the small alien lying on his carpet, blood seeping through his long red hair and staining his hideous clothing. In the immense kitchen, the whirring of the great ceiling fans filled the room with a steady, throbbing hum as they struggled with the heat from the ovens. Paul Labar was in the corner with his spices, mixing his own Cajun blackening powder for the tuna, and roaring his displeasure at anyone who tried to see what he was doing. Rows of potatoes Hiram covered a dozen long trays, cut and seasoned and ready for baking, and 6 fat suckling pigs were being dressed and prepared. Prep cooks were washing vegetables and slicing them with slim, sharp knives, and the pastry chef was fretting over a triple chocolate sour cream tort fresh from the oven. Hiram surveyed it all, tried a taste of the sour cherry sauce being prepared for the pork, exchanged a few words with his associé, and escaped every bit as restless as when he'd entered. What if Tachyon wasn't dead yet? What if he were just dying? Someone needed to check on him, but Fortunato had warned Hiram not to leave, hadn't he? If he went over to Tachyon's apartment and the astronomer attacked Aces High in his absence and perhaps even killed someone, he would never be able to live with himself. But how could he live with himself if he stayed here and Dr. Tachyon died as a result? Aces High occupied the entire floor. Its dining area is terraced so all the customers might enjoy the magnificent views its altitude afforded in all directions. The kitchen, storage lockers, freezer, restrooms, service elevator, and offices were in the center. Hiram made the grand circuit, supervising everything, nodding to his staff, his mind a long way off. The temporary waiters were clustered around one of the tables, listening to his captain explain how things were done at Aces High. They looked a motley crew in their jeans and shoddy jackets and Dodger windbreakers, but once in tuxes and blue silk shirts, they'd look as good as his regulars. Elsewhere, linen carts were making the rounds as teams of busboys unfolded crisp, clean tablecloths across the round banquet tables. Curtis was talking to the wine steward. Off by a window, he saw Water Lily, standing by herself and staring out at the gold reflections off the top of the Chrysler Building. She wore a floor-length blue satin gown that left her right shoulder bare. She looked very lovely and somehow sad. Hiram started toward her, but there was something in her eyes that made him hesitate to intrude on her. He paused a moment, then turned and left. Peter Chow had a small office next to Hiram's, in the center of the floor, but instead of one television screen in the wall, he had a dozen. Hiram entered without knocking. "Are we secure?" he asked. Peter looked at him with cool brown eyes. "I've added a few men," he said. "No one will get in without us noticing, believe me." He gestured at the screens. "The monitors are all working, and so is the metal detector in the main door. I have 6 men on the floor instead of 3. We're secure as we're going to get, at least against human beings."
"Excellent. I have to go out for a little while. I'll try to be back as quickly as possible, but it may take longer than I anticipate. Wait till I've left, then bring Modular Man and Water Lily into your office. Explain our security system to them. Explain the system in great detail. Keep them in here, with you, together, for as long as possible, preferably until I return." Chow nodded. Hiram went to the foyer, pressed the elevator button, rocked back on his heel for a moment, then pressed the button again, as if that would make the elevator come more quickly. When the doors finally opened, he rushed to board, and almost slammed into Popinjay getting out.
"You!" Hiram exclaimed. "Excellent, just the man I hoped to see. Come with me. We're going to see Dr. Tachyon."
Aykroyd stepped back inside the elevator. Hiram pushed for the lobby, and they began their descent. "How did it go with Gills?" Hiram asked.
"Not real good," Popinjay said. "By the time I talked Gills around, Bludgeon was out again. He's got good lawyers. I think they're going to sue me."
His mouth twisted in a half-smile.
"You too, probably." "Gills was afraid to go home. I popped him back to my sister's place. He ought to be safe there, and we'll know where to find him if we need him."
"Damnation! Can't we get rid of even one of the bad guys? I don't know what this city is coming to."
Aykroyd shrugged. "Why are we visiting Tachyon?"
Hiram gave him a glum look. "I'm afraid," he said, "that he might be dead."
Bagabond leaned forward, away from the brick wall of the alley. She steadied herself with a dumpster. The alley smelled of recent garbage. Rosemary was looking around a bit apprehensively.
"Relax, we're alone."
"You don't get to read all the crime reports I do," Rosemary said. "You haven't seen the photos detectives snap in places like this. You haven't had to go to the morgue to check out..."
"Quiet,"
said Bagabond. "Get him?"
"He's uptown from us, and a ways to the east. I guess about Stuyvesant Square. Underground, of course."
"I don't think anyone would even notice today," Rosemary said. "Does he still have the books?"
"As far as I can tell, he doesn't really remember or notice what's in his gut. It's the absence that makes the difference. But there's no reason the package shouldn't still be there."
Rosemary took a step towards the mouth of the alley. It's quite a ways, especially today. We better get started if we're going to make it back to the Haifong Lily by 8. She smiled ruefully at Vagabond. Then I'll figure out what I'm going to do. Vagabond frowned.
Jack's still moving, but so slowly we can connect with him easily. We should take the subway. Cabs will be a mess.
She saw him Rosemary tense, but didn't comment. Then she grinned.
I've never known an animal to be so constantly hungry as that alligator. I just hope he doesn't connect with us.
Rosemary's eyebrows rose.
He's too worried about his niece for that, Vagabond said. He just doesn't know it on the surface level of that reptile brain.
She shook her head, thinking about appetites, and led the way out of the alley and into the loud holiday crowds. They entered the chaos of chants, exotic food carts, screams, and rock and roll.
The book's not here, Tacky. Where is the book? The explosive sibilance indicated the Joker's fast vanishing patience. Almost 1,000 books, and they can't find one that suits them. I call it churlish and a reflection upon my taste. Or theirs, offered Roulette. Tachyon snapped his head back to face Snakeface, the sudden gesture forestalling the blow. I don't know about this ephemeral book. You say it was given to me. No one has given me a book this day. I have spent the past 6 hours in this lady's company. Did anyone give me a book? No. You've got it. The tongue once more played across the alien's face and down his chest. I tasted it on her, and if I have to take the nigger apart to get it, I will. A blunt forefinger tipped with a fantastically thick and sharp nail drove into her shoulder, and Roulette stifled a cry. What was coming was going to be a lot worse than a finger jabbing into a numb, aching shoulder, and she better be prepared. All right, I'll be reasonable. The book isn't here. I put it in a safe place. And you're going to take us there. Yes, but you have to let her go. No, I think she'll come along. Then, no book. Then I redesign her face. The doorbell rang. There was a sudden shifting of their captors. Guns touched reassuringly. Tommy starting for the door, then dropping back. Snakey jumping for Tachyon, but the alien had also seen the possibilities and sang out. Yes, one moment, please. Fuck you, I ought to break your scrawny neck, hissed the Joker, his hand closing around the doctor's throat. Better let him answer the door instead, whispered Roulette, since Tachyon's face was suffusing with blood, and he didn't seem capable of answering for himself. Otherwise, they'll know something's wrong and come back with help. We'll wait it out. It may be the paperboy or the Mormons. But it was neither. A man's voice, deep, bass, cultured, but bearing a thread of strain and agitation, called, Tack, I must speak with you. Is everything all right? Tell him yes. Yes, Tachyon obligingly mimicked, then coughed, trying to ease the soreness in his throat. Who is this man? Hiram Worcester. Okay. You can answer the door, but get rid of him fast. Better clean his face, Roulette offered in the same flat tone she'd maintained since the beginning of this nightmare. She was both pleased and bemused by her control. Inwardly, she was a shrieking mess. Do it! A handkerchief was thrust at her, while Tommy untied her. Within seconds, the tips of her fingers began to burn as the blood flowed back into her hands. Tack? Coming, he replied, as Roulette dipped the cloth into the vase on the coffee table and quickly began wiping away the worst of the gore from his face. The right side's not too bad, she whispered, but don't let him see that shiner. The left eye was so badly damaged that it had swollen completely shut. I'll be careful, he said in a carefully neutral tone, but his right eye seemed feverishly bright, the gaze intent. She again felt that cloud kiss about the edges of her mind, and she understood, or at least hoped or thought she understood. This might be their chance. She gave his hand a quick squeeze and was rewarded by a flash of that sweet smile, somewhat marred now by the split and swollen lip. Two of their captors took up a position on the wall beside the door, one behind and slightly to the left of Tachyon, gun pressed into the alien's kidneys. Tommy laid a hand on Roulette's right shoulder. The reptilian joker indicated the kitchen with a jerk of the head, and Wasp flitted away. The droning of his wings lessened in intensity. Tachyon barely cracked the door, peeped out.
Hiram, what on earth took you so long?
I'm entertaining, a subtle stress on the final word.
You've unplugged your phone. We've been trying to get in touch with you for hours.
The Joker laid a hand over Tachyon's, trying to force the door shut, but Tachyon threw himself backward, pulling it open. The alien went sprawling, and the portly and impeccably dressed Hiram came willy-nilly into the room.
Hey, said a second man as he stepped through the door, then snapped his mouth shut as a gun was thrust into his side.
Snake Face quietly closed the door.
Good God, Tachyon, what is all this? What does it look like, Hiram?
He scrambled to his feet and sent a sour look about the room. Two of the Chinese moved in and briskly searched the newcomers.
They're clean.
What do we do now? Whined Tommy.
Shut up.
The smaller man gave a gollywog's grin, thrust a hand into his pocket, and pointed with his forefinger.
Okay, everybody freeze. I've got you covered.
Even Tachyon looked disgusted, and someone said,
Fuck off, asshole. I just frisked you down.
The man shrugged, removed his hand, studied the finger for a long moment, then pointed it at the Joker and said,
Pop!
Snake Face vanished. Two of the Chinese clutched their heads and collapsed with a sigh.
Hiram, look out! Bellowed Tachyon.
The big man hesitated for an instant, then belly flopped between sofa and coffee table as Tommy let go with his .45 right next to Roulette's ear. There was an ear-splitting boom, and the delicate bowl on the coffee table shattered, sending a cascade of water and blossoms across Hiram's back, and leaving a single gardenia perched forlornly on the curve of his ample rump. At Tachyon's yell, Hiram's companion stepped backward, opened the door, and vanished into the hall. The Chinese immediately behind the alien raised his gun, then formed a snoring puddle on the floor. Tachyon pivoted to face Tommy. It was a face-off. Tachyon's power versus the jerk of a finger on a trigger. Which would be faster? Roulette seized the empty chair beside her and slammed it into Tommy's shins. He howled, dropped the gun, and went for her, arms outstretched like a drunk, trying to embrace an elusive lover. Roulette danced back, poking at him with the chair. There was a buzz like a thousand angry bees, and Wasp came blitzing out of the kitchen. Hiram, heaving off the floor like a breaching whale, tightened his fist, and the Joker slammed into the floor, wings folding like an origami figure. Tommy grasped a leg of the chair, and for an instant they played tug-of-war as Roulette tried to keep a grip on her inadequate defense. His free hand groped at his back, and he pulled free a knife. Roulette abandoned her defense of the chair and ran, screaming. He caught her by the hair and swung her across his body. She never knew whether he meant to use her as a hostage or to kill her out of hand, for suddenly his face went slack, and he let out a loud, Oof! The arm across her chest felt like a steel girder, and they both collapsed in a heap. She struggled free, though it felt like he weighed several tons. This was more than her overset nerves could stand. The screams that had been tearing at her throat subsided into hysterical laughter and degenerated from there into hiccuping sobs. Hush, hush.
Gentle hands stroked her hair, wiped away the tears, held her close. You're quite safe now. It's all over. She laid her head on Tachyon's shoulder and drew a shaky breath.
What the devil is going on here?
Hiram exploded in aggrieved accents. Tachyon righted a chair, eased Roulette into it.
Hiram, my deepest thanks. Yours was a timely arrival. Who are these men? Damned if I know. They wanted a book. Worcester's brown eyes goggled, and he stared suspiciously at his friend, as if suspecting inebriation.
Hiram's companion thrust his head around the door.
Should we call the police?
Tachyon stepped to meet him, extended a hand.
My thanks to you as well, but what did you do to—
He made a helpless gesture at the space that a few seconds before had contained Snake Face. The man in the brown suit shrugged.
I'm a projecting teleport. Point my fingers, and pop. They're gone.
Where?
Where has he gone?
The men's room at Freaker's.
The men's room at—
He shrugged. I can only send people to some place I know.
Wish you had known the tombs.
Oh, I do, but— He shuffled his feet, stared at the ceiling, glanced at Hiram, looked back to Tachyon.
I already sent one guy there today, and the cops are pissed. I didn't want any more trouble.
So we've lost him, and I'll never know what book.
I'd say that's the least of our worries today, Hiram said.
Why?
If certain people would show more responsibility and not unplug their phones, they wouldn't have to ask.
Don't be testy.
Tachyon, I've had a rather difficult day.
I've had better myself.
They stared in silence at each other. Then Worcester sighed and ran a hand across his bald pate and smoothed down his full beard.
Tachyon smiled and said in a softer tone,
Shall we try again? He tightened the belt on his robe, seated himself on the arm of the sofa. Now, what brought you here?
Excuse me, but what about these goons? Asked Roulette.
You needn't worry. They will sleep for a good many hours.
And him? She pointed at the wasp.
He weighs about 600 pounds, Hiram answered. I doubt he'll go anywhere.
Oh, she said faintly.
The astronomer's raging through the city, Hiram said. I was afraid he might have gotten to you already. You know about the Howler, of course. Kid Dinosaur's dead, too, torn to pieces at Jet Boy's tomb. And the turtle was attacked and reportedly crashed into the Hudson. He hasn't been seen since.
Worcester caught the slight doctor as he swayed and eased him onto the couch.
Brandy, he snapped.
And Roulette forced tension back into her weak knees and obeyed.
I apologize for putting it so baldly, but there's no good way to deliver news like that.
I cannot believe.
The turtle, you say?
And that child?
Tachyon covered his face with his hands. In a few brutal words, Worcester praised them of the events at the tomb.
Roulette didn't notice when Hiram lifted the glass from her slack fingers. She was seeing a pointed-faced kid, cute despite the wash of pimples across his chin, teasing his elders. She wondered what his dreams and goals had been, and she felt anguish for his parents. A sound that was both an agonized cry and a sob tore from her, and she went down into darkness. Unfortunately, it was not empty. Within waited the twisted body of her child and the burning eyes of her master.
Fortunato got as far as a middle-aged woman guarding the entrance to the NBC sound stages. He could see the skating rink at Rockefeller Plaza through the huge window to his right. He couldn't get any sense of Peregrine being in the building, but she was an ace, and it was possible she could block him somehow.
I'm sorry, sir, but we simply can't give out that kind of information about our performers.
Fortunato locked eyes with her, Pager, he said. Her hand moved involuntarily to the phone, then hesitated. She's not in the building. Letterman's doing her show tonight. Tell me where she is. The woman shook her head. Her tightly permed red hair followed her every move. I can't. She looked like she was about to cry. She had some important dinner to go to tonight. That's why she's not here for the taping. All right, Fortunato said. Thank you. You've been very helpful. The woman smiled tentatively. Fortunato leaned his head against the elevator doors as he dropped back down to street level. They still hadn't found the turtle's body. Peregrine's apartment was empty. Nobody had seen Jumpin' Jack Flash in weeks. The game had been going on for 17 years, and now it was down to the last 12 hours. He's beating the shit out of me, Fortunato thought. The only time I ever hurt him was when I broke that fucking machine and stopped Tiamat. He was exhausted. Up all night with the Mirror of Hathor chasing around uselessly ever since. You have to turn it around, he told himself. Strike back at him. Hurt him. He wanted it so bad he could taste it. But how could he even find someone that he couldn't see? How?
Chapter 13, 6 p.m. Spectre decided to go ahead and hit the Gambionis for Latham and his Shadow Fist friends. He had to operate on the assumption that he'd find a way to keep the astronomer from killing him. If he could manage that, his new connections might mean some big jobs in the very near future. He didn't like spending money on clothes, but there was no way he could go into the Haifong Lily with blood spattered all over his suit. He decided on this clothing store because it didn't look like much from the outside. It didn't look like much from the inside, either. There were no fancy dressing rooms and too much dust on the floor. It was his kind of place. Spectre slid a dark brown coat off the rack and pulled it on. He walked over to the mirror and winced. He looked like a man in a fudgesicle. "Can I help you, sir?" The clerk was short, with tufts of curly red hair on the sides of his head and a white cloth tape measure draped round his neck. Spectre struggled out of the coat. His arm was still bothering him. His sweat-soaked shirt clung to him. "I need a suit. Brown's not my color. Got anything in gray?" The clerk walked over to the rack and started poking through the suits. He was muttering to himself and shaking his head. Spectre made sure no one was looking, then pulled a few $100 bills out of his brown envelope. The little man turned around, holding an ash-gray suit. "This has possibilities, I think. Is this yours?" He pointed to Spectre's old coat, which was lying on a straight-back chair. The clerk looked close and ran his hands over the material. "What's this all over? Bloodstains?" "It's fake blood. I was down in Jokertown earlier. Pretty wild down there." Spectre took the gray jacket and put it on. It was a little large, but fit him well in the shoulders. "I'll take it." "What? Don't you want to try on the pants?" The clerk blinked and stood up straight. "That's why I've got a belt." "How much is it?" He draped the pants over his good arm.
"With alterations? $250. Nice material, though. Worth every penny. You can't get workmanship like this often anymore."
"I don't need any alterations," Spectre said. The clerk opened his mouth to speak, but Spectre raised a finger. "I've got an aunt in Jersey who loves to do this kind of stuff. So how much?"
$220.
Spectre handed him the money and picked up his other coat, feeling for the envelope to make sure it was still there. He looked in the mirror again. Not bad, he thought. You may be the best-dressed killer at the Haifong Lily tonight. He dropped his old pants and stepped into the new ones. They were big on him, but he'd manage. The clerk returned with Spectre's receipt and change.
"Here you go, sir. Let us know if you change your mind about those alterations. I can promise you, the finest fit in town.
Spectre took the money and thrust it into his pocket. Sure. The bell over the doorway tinkled as he opened it to step outside. An angel just got his wings. He cleaned out the pockets of his old suit as he walked down the street, then dumped it into the first trash can he saw.
The alligator had a waking dream, or at least as much of a dream as reptiles have. He was no longer here in the tunnel deep below the pulsating city. He was someplace else, somewhere warmer and lighter, where the water was hospitable and frequently full of live, darting food. The reptile ghosted along the bayou, most of his body concealed below the surface, with nostrils and orbital ridges protruding up out of the water and cutting small wakes. After a time, he entered a place where the trees seemed to grow upside down, their gnarled roots twisting in dense wooden knots above the water. Above him, the canopy of interlaced branches blocked most of the sun. Shadows increasingly dappled his back as he slid along. Sounds came to him, amplified by the water. He recognized the patterns. Food, though food that sometimes could injure him if he were incautious. He homed in on the vibrations. Around the curve of a deeper channel, beyond an almost impenetrable copse of cypress, he saw the pirogue. The two men in it did not see him, busy as they were, poking long poles into the plaited jumble of wood at water level. More sounds came. The man wearing a cap said, "She got be in there someplace, Jake." The other man shouted so loud the alligator had to contract its hearing openings.
"Bitch, you come out of there! Dis your granduncle speaking, dear you?"
"You tell us, Snake Jake," said the first man.
"I tell you, girl, I don't want hurt you," he chuckled. "Leastways, nothing you won't like."
The alligator swept remorselessly toward the pirogue. There was no debate, nothing but intent. He did what he did because of what he was and who they were. He slid deeper and came up beneath the boat, lifting the prow high into the bayou shadows. The two men yelled and plunged into the water. The alligator did not care who was first. He would have them both. His jaws stretched wide, teeth ready to rend. And he was back in the dark tunnel below the city. The alligator mindlessly placed one foot in front of the other, continuing his imponderable, slow-motion odyssey. The dream stayed as vivid as reality in his mind. So much as he could consider the issue, he didn't know whether the dream was something that had happened once, or was something that would happen. Either way was fine. It didn't matter.
Using the set of keys Jack had given her years before, Vagabond opened yet another gray metal door, revealing a set of steps descending into darkness. She reached down to pick up the soft bundle she had laid at her feet. "How much farther?" Those were the only words Rosemary had spoken since they had entered the subway system at Chambers Street.
"Down these stairs and a few hundred yards along a tunnel, I think."
Vagabond closed and locked the door behind them. The metal clinked dully.
"What's bothering you?"
"Nothing."
"Don't give me that," said Vagabond. "It must be pretty heavy to keep you from talking."
Rosemary took an audible breath. "Ever since my father died, and Cece... I hate subways, tunnels, all of this. It's 15 years ago, but that night is still a blur, and I don't want to remember." The words ran down like clockwork exhausting a mainspring.
"But you want the books,"
Vagabond said practically, grasping Rosemary by the shoulder and pulling her around to face her. In the dim yellow light, the attorney's eyes were black shadows. Vagabond probed Rosemary for weakness. The attorney took another deep breath. "I'm here. I'm going on, but you can't stop me from thinking what this place did to Cece." Rosemary shrugged away from Vagabond. "Don't worry about it, all right?"
"I don't think I'm the one who's worried."
Rosemary's foot was on the first step when the two women heard the muffled chuffing sounds of the alligator, followed by a growl. Rosemary's lips paled as she set her mouth tightly. Vagabond nodded to herself with satisfaction.
That's Jack.
Rosemary lagged Vagabond perceptibly as they approached the alligator. At their approach, the reptile stopped and swung his heavy head toward them, eyes glittering in the cold light of the tunnel. He roared a challenge that made both women wince as the sound crashed and reverberated against the stone walls.
Stay here. I'll call you when it's finished.
Vagabond sloshed toward Sewer Jack, gently moving inside his head now. Heedless of her clothing, she knelt in the tunnel muck and stroked the alligator's lower jaw as she mentally reached further inside for the key to Jack Robichaud. Finding a spark of humanity deep within the reptile brain, she cradled it, fanning it, drawing it out, calming both the proto-human synapses and the distinctly reptile brain. As the alligator mind receded, Vagabond withdrew and watched as the long, armored tail grew smaller and the snout diminished. The short legs of the animal elongated into the arms and legs of a man. The naked man, now lying on the tunnel floor, gasped and cried out in pain as he wrapped his arms around his stomach. His face and hands grew gray-green, again lapped with scales, as the process began to reverse itself.
Jack, it's Vagabond. Control it!
She spoke sharply, taking the man's hand tightly between her own. She moved with him as Jack rolled onto his back, panting hoarsely. Vagabond tried to penetrate back into his head, but now was blocked by the human intelligence there. Jack opened his eyes and looked directly into hers. He convulsed once, but took a deep breath and lay back. Although livid, the texture of his skin was normal again. His breathing slowed to a normal rate. Running a hand across his face, Jack grimaced.
I know I always ask this, but it's important. Where am I?
He glanced down at Vagabond's hand and released it, looking away self-consciously.
Trace Tyvison Square, said Vagabond. Maybe 100 feet below it. It's about 6 at night.
She reached across him in one unconscious motion and pushed the damp, black hair back off his face.
Here are some clothes. I got them out of your cache at Union Square.
Vagabond handed him the bundle she had been carrying.
Rosemary's here. A little ways up the tunnel. I assume there's a reason you're both here.
Jack stiffly got up, one hand to his belly, the other holding his forehead.
I feel like shit.
He painfully pulled on the chinos and work shirt.
It's something you ate, Vagabond said laconically. That pain in your gut, it's no tin can. It's books. Very important books. So I ate a librarian? Wonderful.
Jack ran his fingers through his matted hair and looked up at the ceiling of the passage.
My card's expired anyway. Vagabond shook her head. From what I saw, you ate a thief. The thief just happened to be carrying notebooks that every criminal in the city would kill any 20 grandmothers for.
And I want those notebooks so I can find out why. Rosemary walked up to them, her usual poise regained. There's a meeting of the Gambioni family in a couple hours. If I have those books, I think I can stop a bloodbath.
So ask me if I care, said Jack.
He grimaced.
My niece has been wandering around New York City for almost 12 hours. By now, she could be dog food. That's my problem. I'm going to find her, then we'll discuss your precious books.
Jack winced, doubling over as he started to walk back toward the steps. Robichaud, I can make your life miserable. Rosemary started to follow him.
Shut up, Rosemary, Vagabond said. Jack, there's one more thing you should know.
Her voice was flat and it stopped him.
It's not just the Mafia looking for these things. They're the sweethearts. The others are using jokers, maybe aces too. If you hit the street knowing what's inside you, you're a dead man before you can whistle up a cab. Some telepath will pick it up and they'll gut you like a pig. Then what about Cordelia?
She let several moments go by.
I can't protect you out there, but I can look for Cordelia while you're out of sight. And mind. So how long?
Jack tried to straighten, but gasped again in pain.
Rosemary?
Vagabond took Jack's arm and supported him. 2 hours outside. That will get the books to the meeting. That's all I want. Rosemary stared at Sewer Jack and waited. He met her eyes.
You got 2 hours, lady. That's all. And if Vagabond can't find Cordelia, I want your people on it. Every cop in the borough.
Deal? Jack swayed against Vagabond, putting one hand out to the wall. Rosemary smiled. Deal.
Time seemed to flow differently within the confines of the small church. Perhaps it was the quiet darkness lit only by flickering votive candles and a few fluorescent lamps. Perhaps it was the reverent silence of the parishioners praying in the pews. Whatever the cause, the peace and tranquility she'd found within the small church had gone a long way toward calming her distraught nerves. Jennifer began to take her safety for granted, and her mind wandered. She studied the bizarre symbolism in the stained glass windows above the equally strange dioramas depicting Jesus Christ Joker's 12 stations of the cross, but soon wearied of their obtuse theology. Her stomach growled with discontent, and she looked toward the altar, wondering what was keeping Father Squid. The parishioners praying silently around her were all jokers, though the deformities of some were more obvious than others. There was a bearded triclops, a pretty, shapely woman with a glossy pelt covering every visible inch of exposed skin, and a sweet-faced altar boy who moved jerkily but carefully about the altar, rearranging things and replenishing the stock of wine and wafers. Jennifer heard the sound of a soft footstep behind her and whirled around, an image of Worm and the memory of his tongue rasping her skin leaping into her mind. She relaxed when she saw it wasn't the reptilian Joker creeping up behind her, but just a girl who was as startled by Jennifer's sudden movement as Jennifer had been by her quiet approach.
I'm sorry, she said. I didn't mean to scare you.
She was a tall, slender, very beautiful teenager with very black, very glossy hair and dark brown eyes. She wore worn jeans and a faded sweatshirt with the name of the rock band Ferric Jagger imprinted upon it in washed-out letters. She wore no makeup and only a single piece of jewelry, a silver ear stud in the shape of an alligator. The gator's eyes were small green gems. Her voice was soft and melodic and had a pleasingly exotic drawl to it that Jennifer had never heard before. She was carrying an old suitcase covered in faded floral print cloth. "That's all right," Jennifer said, smiling reassuringly. "I'm just a little jumpy." "I've been watching you for a while," the teenager said in her elusive accents. "I noticed that, maybe you could use a sweater or, something else, it being so chilly in here and all." She stopped, smiled shyly, and then added quickly, as if afraid she'd offended Jennifer, "Unless you want to dress, that is, have a reason for wearing that swimming suit to church." Jennifer smiled again, touched by the girl's offer. She was obviously new in town, probably very new in town, maybe even a runaway or in some kind of trouble. Yet she was considerate enough to approach Jennifer and offer help. "That'd be very kind," Jennifer said, "if it wouldn't put you out too much." The girl shook her head, set her suitcase on the flagstone paving of the floor, and opened it. "Wouldn't put me out at all," she said, rummaging through her bag. "Here, try this." It was a large, faded sweatshirt that said Tulane in worn letters. Jennifer slipped it on and smiled at the girl gratefully. "Thanks." She hesitated a moment, then went on. "My name is Jennifer. I've got some things to take care of right now. But later, if you need something, a place to sleep or something, I can take care of myself." "So can I," Jennifer pointed out, hoping it was true. "But it's nice to have someone to rely on every now and then." The girl nodded, returning Jennifer's smile, and Jennifer gave her her phone number as the young altar boy with tousled blonde hair, a cherubic face, and a joker deformity hidden under his distorted cassock approached them with slow and lurching steps. "Father Squid would like to see you," he told Jennifer. Jennifer nodded and turned back to the girl. "What's your name?"
"Cordelia."
"Thanks for the sweatshirt, Cordelia. Be sure to give me a call." Cordelia nodded, and Jennifer followed the boy into the private rooms in the back that had been set aside for the priest to prepare for Mass and conduct church business. He led her to a small, sparsely furnished, unpretentious little room. Father Squid was sitting in a huge old chair behind a cluttered desk. He watched Jennifer unblinkingly as she entered, as did the man who sat in the plain wooden chair in front of the priest's desk.
"I have discovered from a reliable source that this man has been searching for you for some time. You have something he wants. In return, he offers you his protection."
Father Squid rose ponderously to his feet.
"I have it on good authority that you can trust him explicitly. I don't know his name, but his nom de guerre is Yeoman."
It was the man she had first seen in the stadium, the man who had later, perhaps inadvertently, rescued her from Worm. He wore the same clothes and hood. A flat rectangular case was on the floor by his feet. There was speculation in his dark eyes as he gazed steadily at Jennifer. Father Squid watched them watch each other, then edged around his desk carefully.
"You two doubtless have much of mutual interest to discuss, and there is work for me to accomplish as well. So I shall leave you."
He gave Jennifer a long, kindly look.
"Good luck, my child. Perhaps one day you will come to visit us again."
"I shall, Father." He nodded once at the man he called Yeoman and left the room with ponderous dignity, closing the door behind himself. Jennifer decided that if she didn't have to return the stamps to Kien, that the father would find a sizable donation in his poor box. She owed him that much, even if his attempt to help her didn't fully work out. Jennifer felt Yeoman's eyes on her, and she turned and met the weight of their steady gaze. "Kien's diary," he said. His voice was low and powerful. Jennifer sensed a quivering tenseness about him, as if he was barely holding himself in check. "Do you have it?" So that's what the third book was, a diary. She opened her mouth, then shut it, wondering if she could afford to tell him the truth. Yeoman's intensity frightened Jennifer a little, but the fear combined with her hunger and weariness and resentfulness at being pushed around all day made her answer back in a hard voice that surprised even her. "I know what you look like, so you might as well take off that mask. I don't like talking to people who look like they have something to hide." The man sat back in his chair and scowled. "I'll keep it on, for now." His features, as Jennifer remembered, were sharp and harsh, with frown lines on his forehead and around his mouth, and there was a vibrating tenseness about him that his mask couldn't conceal. "You're called Wraith?" he asked unexpectedly. Jennifer nodded. "You're a thief. A good one, from what I've heard. You broke into the apartment of a man named Kien early this morning and removed some valuable items from a wall safe." "How do you know all that?" "A crystal lady told me," he said, looking a little pleased by Jennifer's look of irritated incomprehension. "A lot of people are looking for you, you know. They want the things you stole." "Well," Jennifer said noncommittally, "the stamps are very valuable." Yeoman leaned forward in his chair and rested his chin in the palm of a large, strong-looking hand. He stared at her intently. Jennifer looked back defiantly until he sighed and spoke again. "You really don't know, do you?" She shook her head, trying to hide a rising excitement. Yeoman evidently knew the answers to some of her most pressing questions. "To hell with the stamps. No one gives a damn about them. Everyone's after the other book you took, Kien's personal diary. It details all the corruption and rot he's had his filthy hands in since he's come to New York. I thought he was a businessman. Owns restaurants and laundromats and things." "He does," Yeoman said, "but only as a masquerade, and to explain his wealth. He's into everything that's dirty. Drugs, prostitution, protection, gambling. He's into it all. The information contained in that diary would probably put him away for a very long time." "Are you trying to recover it for him?" Yeoman's lips were pressed into a hard, tight line. Knots of muscle jumped in his jaw. "No." The word that escaped from between his clenched lips was hard, flat, and cold enough to make Jennifer suppress a shiver. "And you don't care about the stamps?" He shook his head. His eyes had captured hers. She felt as if she were a sparrow held in the grip of a massive, now calm, but potentially destructive giant. It was a frightening, yet somehow exhilarating feeling. "Okay," she said slowly. "You don't care about the stamps. I don't care about this diary. I think that we can come to an understanding." Yeoman smiled, and again Jennifer suppressed a shiver. "Then you do have it." "Well, I know where it is." She fell silent for a moment, considering. She didn't know this yeoman from Adam. She knew that he was behind the recent spate of bow and arrow killings, since notes signed yeoman had been scrawled on many of the crime scenes. Father Squid said he could be trusted, but then she didn't know Father Squid either. He waited patiently as this all ran through her mind, as if aware that she was trying to resolve an internal dilemma. He wasn't acting like a murderous maniac. He was manifestly a dangerous man. But the dangerous aura that hung about him was like a spice, an alluring scent. A sudden resolve struck her, sparked by an equally strong impulse. "I'll tell you where the book is," she said, "if you answer two questions." "What?" There was genuine puzzlement on Yeoman's face and in his voice. "How'd you trace me to Ebbets Field?" "Simple," he grinned wolfishly. "Your fence turned you in." He heard the word that Kian had put out on the streets about the books, but he didn't know how to contact Kian directly. He had to go through a third party, an information broker who's a friend of mine. She put him in touch with Kian, but she also told me about it. I got to his shop just in time to see you leave one of the stores next to the pawn shop, go down the street, and join the ticket line in front of the ballpark. I just followed you inside." "That makes sense, I guess. Now, my second question." She smiled sweetly. "What's your name?" Jennifer herself barely understood why she asked him that, knowing only that she wanted them to interact on a personal level, not as anonymous masked figures. He drew back in his chair, frowned at her. "I could make you tell me where the diary is." Jennifer pulled the sweatshirt more tightly around her. Her throat was suddenly dry with the realization that she was treading in dangerous, potentially fatal waters. "I know you could," she said in a small voice. "But you wouldn't." "What in the world makes you say that?" She shrugged slim shoulders. "I just know you wouldn't." He stared at her a moment longer, but she wouldn't drop her gaze. He growled something inarticulate, like an irate bear, and then said in an angry voice, "Brennan." Jennifer nodded, obscurely relieved that she had been correct. Not that she had really been in danger. Her powers had certainly rejuvenated by now, and if he had attacked her, all she would have had to do was ghost. "Good," she said. "The books are with Dr. Tachyon." "Tachyon?" Brennan said in obvious astonishment. "Actually," she smiled, "in his wax figure in the Bowery Dime Museum." "Not a bad hiding place," Brennan said after a moment of reflection. "Kian's men are still looking for you. Once Worm tastes a scent, he can follow it anywhere, as long as traces of it remain on his tongue. So I'll take you to a safe place and then go after the books. I'll keep the diary. You can have the others."
"I'll go with you."
"No." The word was as hard and sharp as the edge of a guillotine blade. Jennifer knew there'd be no arguing with him about this. "Well, if you're going to take me someplace, make it a place with food. I feel like I haven't eaten in a week." Brennan thought for a moment, then nodded. He reached into a back pocket of his jeans and took out a playing card, an ace of spades, borrowed a pen from Father Squid's desk, and scrawled a note on the face of the card. He put the pen back and passed the card to Jennifer. "Hiram Worcester is throwing an aces-only party in his restaurant, Aces High. You should be safe there, and there will also be plenty to eat. You've heard of Fortunato?" Jennifer nodded. "Give this to him." Jennifer glanced at the note he'd written on the card. It was short and to the point. Watch over her. Why? She looked up at Brennan, respect in her eyes. She'd heard a little about the shadowy ace, Fortunato. Not much, as he wasn't one to seek publicity, but the fact that Brennan was on personal terms with him was an interesting development. She wondered if he were an ace himself, and what ability the virus had given him. Or Tachyon, if Fortunato's not there. Whatever you do, though, stay away from Captain Trips, the tall, skinny hippie, and the dancer known as Fantasy. I'm not sure about them. Not sure at all. She pondered his advice for a moment, then nodded. If she was to trust him, she'd trust him all the way. I don't want to be a bother, but could we stop for some clothes? I'd hate to go to Ace's Hide dressed like this. The father told me about the state of your, dress. He reached down into the case on the floor by his feet and took out a bundle of clothes. I hope they fit. He looked at her critically. You're taller than I first thought. He studiously looked all about the office while Jennifer stood, pulled the sweatshirt off, and got into a pair of jeans and a dark pullover sweater. She put on the socks Brennan had brought her and looked up from lacing the running shoes to see him gazing at her intently. There was also a mask among the clothing. She stuffed it into the back pocket of her jeans and stood up. The shirt and shoes fit fine, though the jeans were a little short and hugged her slim figure tightly. She folded the sweatshirt neatly and left it on the priest's desk with a short explicatory note. Right. Brennan stood and hefted his case. First stop, Empire State Building. He smiled in satisfaction. If you're not going to be safe in a room full of aces, you wouldn't be safe anywhere.
Upstairs in his mother's brownstone, in the comfortable luxury of the Upper West Side, Fortunato closed his eyes. Miranda straightened his black tie with skillful fingers. She was in her late 40s now, heavier than she should have been if she was still a geisha, wearing tailored Chanel instead of low-cut ready-to-wear. She'd become his mother's business manager 10 years ago and hadn't turned a trick since. You look bad, she said. Is Veronica not working out? No, Fortunato said. I don't think she's going to make it. I never understood her. All she wants is to be married and have kids and put them in daycare, to have a husband she never sees, to have servants and cars and money. I keep asking myself what I did wrong. It's not you. It's the whole country. Greed is very chic these days. She touched his lips, and the skin tingled. You're very tired. Exhausted. I used to know the cure for that. She was standing very close. He could smell her perfume and the sweetness of her skin. She read the willingness in his face and said, Lie down. He stretched out across the bed. She took off her jacket and skirt. Fortunato reached for his tie, and she said, Don't move. She took the rest of her clothes off. She was still graceful enough to get out of her pantyhose without breaking the mood. Her bra had left lines around her chest and over her shoulders, and there was dark stubble under her arms. She got onto the bed and straddled Fortunato and began to touch herself. She started with her forehead and let her fingers trickle down her cheeks and back up to where her ears met her jawline. Goosebumps came up on her neck. She swayed forward until her full, sagging breasts were inches from his face. He leaned up to kiss them, and she pulled away. No, she said. I told you to hold still. She brushed her broad, dark nipples with her fingertips until they tightened and thrust out at him. Then she brushed lightly over her belly and buried her left hand in her pubic hair. With her right, she touched Fortunato's lips again. He licked her fingers and arched his back. She moved up the bed on her knees and lowered herself onto his mouth. Gently, she said. It's been a long time. As he licked and probed with his tongue, she gradually began to melt and open to him. She took hold of the brass railing of the bed and slowly moved against him, her breath coming faster, her heavy thighs pressing against the sides of his head. Then her body stiffened, and she let out a tiny, hoarse scream, and he drank the power from her, hungrily, gratefully. He felt it tingling through his body and hardly noticed as she bent to kiss him lightly on the mouth. "You taste like me," she said. "Take care, Fortunato." She picked up her clothes and was gone. Fortunato came downstairs to find a circle of beautiful women around the couch in the sitting room. In the middle sat a tall, striking girl in jeans and a long-sleeved t-shirt. "Ichiko," Fortunato said, using his mother's geisha name. "What's the deal?"
"Elroy found her in Jokertown," Ichiko said.
Like Miranda, she'd put on weight in the last 10 years. She was tall anyway, and now she looked positively Anglo-Saxon. She wore a black cotton sweater and skirt with a red and black silk blouse. The top 3 buttons were undone. She moved across the room to Fortunato without sound or visible effort.
"She was coming out of the Church of Jesus Christ, Joker, and looked like she was about to get in trouble with one of Gambioni's scouts. Elroy offered her a ride." She shrugged. "Here she is."
"She's beautiful."
"Yes," Ichiko said. "She is."
"Okay," Fortunato said to the others. "Break it up. Don't you ladies have places you're supposed to be?" They moved off, one at a time, Caroline stopping to slip one arm around his waist as she passed. Then he was alone with her. "I'm Fortunato," he said.
"Cordelia?"
She didn't stand up, but held her hand out to him. Fortunato took it for a second and then sat down next to her.
"I appreciate the rescue," she said.
Her voice was deep, a little breathless, very southern, sexy. "Do you know where you are?"
"Elroy told me a little. He said there were no obligations, but I could hang around for an interview if I wanted."
"And?" "I'm still here, aren't I?" She was flirtatious, but she seemed terribly young. "I'll have to ask you some personal kind of things."
"Like, am I a virgin, you mean?"
"For instance."
"No. I had a regular boyfriend back in Atelier Parish, and, well, you know what they say about virgins from Louisiana. They're just the girls without any close male kin."
She laughed, but Fortunato didn't. "We need to talk some more," he said. "Do you have dinner plans?"
"Dinner plans? Not hardly. But from the way you're dressed, I can't see myself going anywhere with you."
Fortunato looked at his watch. "We can find you something here to wear. How soon could you be ready?"
Chapter 14. 7 p.m. When his barber finished trimming his beard and swept away the apron, Hiram Worcester rose majestically from his chair, shrugged into a perfectly tailored tuxedo jacket, and surveyed himself in the mirror. His shirt was silk, of the deepest, purest blue. His accessories were all silver. Blue and silver were the ace's high colors. "Very good, Henry," Hiram said. He tipped the barber handsomely. Curtis waited just outside his office door. Beyond, his restaurant was ready. Waiters and bartenders stood at their stations. Kelvin Frost's astonishing ice sculptures had been moved out onto the floor, each one surrounded by a moat of crushed ice dotted with bottles of Dom Pérignon. Tables of hot and cold hors d'oeuvre were scattered throughout the restaurant to keep the guests from clumping. The musicians stood poised by their instruments. Overhead, the glittering Art Deco chandeliers shone softly. The beginnings of a magnificent red-gold sunset were visible to the west. Hiram smiled. "Open the doors," he told Curtis. 12 people were already waiting in the foyer when the doors were opened. Hiram bowed to the women and kissed their hands, gave each man a firm handshake, performed the necessary introductions, and pointed them all toward the bar. The early birds tended to be obscure minor aces, insecure of their status and excited by Hiram's invitation. A few, only recently out of the deck, had never been to Aces High before, but Hiram treated them all like long-lost friends. The major aces tended to be fashionably late. The first uninvited guest was a tall, blonde college student who looked uncomfortable in his rented dinner jacket. "What do I have to do to get in? Guess your weight?" he asked when Curtis called Hiram over to pass on his admission. "No," Hiram said, smiling. "That got a bit old, I'm afraid. But I see you've read your wildcard chic." "You bet. So what does it take to get in?" "Show me proof that you've got an ace power," Hiram said. "Right here?" The boy looked around uneasily. "Is it a problem? What is your power, if I might be so bold?" The boy cleared his throat. "It's kind of hard to..." His date giggled. "He gets itsy-bitsy," she announced in a loud, clear voice. The college boy turned a bright shade of red. I compress the molecules of my body, I guess, to make myself smaller. I can shrink down till I'm 6 inches tall." He tried keeping his voice low, but it had gotten very quiet. "My mass stays the same," he added defensively.
"That's some power, kid," Wallace Larrabee opined loudly from the buffet, where he stood holding a tiny buckwheat pancake that sagged dangerously under the weight of the caviar he'd piled atop it.
"Ooh-wee, I'm sure scared."
Hiram wouldn't have thought it possible for the boy to turn a deeper red, but he did.
"Don't mind Wallace," Hiram said. "He nearly ruined our 1978 get-together when he demonstrated his power, and he knows I'll throw him out if he ever does it again. They call him the human skunk."
There was general laughter. Larrabee turned away to load up another pancake, and the boy seemed a bit less mortified. "Well," he said, "the only thing is when I do it, it's like this. I shrink, but my clothes don't." Hiram understood. "Curtis," he said, "take him back to my office and see if he can do what he claims." Curtis smiled. "This way, please." When they re-emerged a few moments later, the maitre d' gave a slight nod, the assembled guests broke into applause, and the boy turned red again. "Welcome to Aces High," Hiram said. "I didn't catch your name." "Frank Beaumont," the college boy replied.
"But I call him Itsy Bitsy," his girlfriend volunteered.
"Gretchen?"
Frank hissed. "You have my word I'll take that secret to my grave," Hiram promised. He caught the eye of a passing waiter. "Soft drinks? Or are you old enough to enjoy some champagne?" he asked Frank and Gretchen. "Please remember, the room is full of telepaths." They settled for soft drinks.
The street in front of the Empire State Building's Fifth Avenue entrance was a madhouse. Paparazzi and celebrity watchers and ace groupies formed a milling gauntlet that scrutinized anyone who tried to enter. Jennifer and Brennan watched from across the street as limos pulled up to the red carpet that had been rolled out from the building's foyer to the curb, and ace after ace was greeted by popping flashbulbs and squeals of delight. Peregrine arrived in her chauffeured Rolls. She wore a backless, strapless black velvet dress that was slit in the front to her navel. She smiled graciously at the milling crowd, but kept her wings curled closely to her body, having dealt with feather-snatching souvenir seekers in the past. Tachyon arrived in a limo. His companion was a gorgeous black woman who wore a gown almost as low-cut as Peregrine's. "I'll have to leave you here," Brennan said, as a cab pulled up and deposited a man in a white skin-tight suit. "Be careful," Jennifer said. Brennan smiled. "It'll be a piece of cake. Remember, stay away from Fantasy and Captain Trips. They may be in Kian's pocket." Jennifer nodded. "One more thing. I can't imagine anything dangerous happening in there, but just in case something goes wrong and you have to leave, I want to set up a meeting place so we don't have to chase each other all over the city again." Brennan thought for a moment. "Times Square, the corner of 43rd and 7th. "Fine," Jennifer said. She wanted to warn him to be careful again, but that was silly. Things were under control, and the adventure was almost over. She felt... She realized, a little regret mixed in with her relief. Brennan lifted a hand in salute, and she waved. She watched him fade silently into the shadows, then put on her mask, turned, and crossed the street.
"Have you heard about the turtle?" Hiram asked, almost the second Fortunato came through the door. "Not since this afternoon. Have they found the shell yet?" Hiram shook his head. "Nothing. I still can't believe it. It's..." He suddenly noticed Cordelia. She'd cleaned up nicely, and Ichiko had found her something white and clinging. "My dear, please excuse my rudeness. I'm Hiram Warchester, proprietor of this establishment." "Cordelia," Fortunato said. Hiram bent over her hand. Fortunato waited him out. "What about Jane? Is she all right?" Hiram pointed to the bar. "She hasn't been out of my sight all afternoon. He's either," he added, pointing to the android next to her. Fortunato nodded, saw the bottle of unblended scotch by Modular Man's right hand. "Is he drunk?"
"I heard that," Modular Man said, with great dignity. "I am an android and incapable of becoming intoxicated in any conventional human sense."
He made an artificial throat-clearing noise.
"I have initiated a subroutine which somewhat randomizes my thought processes, simulating the effects of alcohol, but it will be overridden at any sign of danger. I assure you, I am not drunk."
He turned back to Waterlily, who was staring into a Shirley Temple and nursing her impatience.
"Now, where were we?"
"Fortunato," Waterlily said. "Hang on," Fortunato said. "Just another couple of minutes." He could see Peregrine across the room. He turned back to Hiram and said, "Would you show Cordelia around for me? There's something I need to take care of."
"I'd be delighted."
The knot of men around Peregrine saw him coming and drifted away. By the time he got to her, it was just the two of them. She wore long gloves with her gown, which left plenty of room for her broad, muscular shoulders and the big brown and white wings that came out of her back. It was cut so low that she must have glued it on. In her spiked heels, she was just over 6 feet tall. Her brown hair had been styled with a deliberate artlessness that took up several cubic feet around her head. Her nose and cheekbones were so sharply cut, they looked like the product of sculpture rather than genetics. Her eyes were such a vivid shade of blue that Fortunato suspected contact lenses. But the expression in them took him a little by surprise. The eyes glittered like they were about to squint shut with laughter, and one side of her mouth twisted up in an ironic smile.
"My name is Fortunato," he said.
"So I hear." She looked him up and down slowly. Miranda had left him with a lingering taste of musk and a clearly visible erection. Peregrine's smile grew wider. "Hiram said you've been looking for me."
"I think you could be in very serious danger."
"Well, not at the moment, maybe, but I could see it as a distinct possibility."
"I'm afraid I'm serious. The Howler and Kid Dinosaur are already dead. The astronomer killed them both this morning. Not to mention about 10 or 15 of his former associates. The turtle is missing and probably dead. You and Tachyon and Waterlily are the next most obvious targets."
Wait a minute. I'm getting the picture. You're the only one that can save me, right? So after dinner, you should come back to the penthouse with me and guard my body, right? As in all night long."
"I promise you..."
"I'm a little disappointed, Fortunato. After everything I've heard, I'd hoped for something, well, a bit more romantic. Not this kind of lame approach. Original, mind you." She reached out and patted his cheek. "But very lame." She walked away, smiling. Fortunato let her go. At least she was here now, where she would be safe. He looked for Cordelia and spotted her talking to an Arab in a circus costume. The Arab was trying, with some success, to see down the front of her dress. She had talent, Fortunato thought. She could play a man like a fish,
seemed smart and funny, and not prohibitively fussy. If he took her on, it would be up to him to break her in. It was the kind of job he normally looked forward to. But in this case, he had doubts. She seemed so goddamn innocent. There was a commotion at the door. Hiram was pumping Tachyon's arm, overdoing the genial host bit. Next to Tachyon was the woman Fortunato had seen him with at Jetboy's tomb. The woman glanced his way for a second, and Fortunato recognized her. She did freelance outcall, and she was very expensive. Expensive the way blowfish was expensive in Japan, because every man who went with her risked his life. Every so often, supposedly at random, she secreted a deadly poison when she climaxed. Her nickname on the street was Russian Roulette. Tachyon would be okay, Fortunato thought. He didn't see much chance the little alien fruitcake would be able to make a woman like that come.
Are you certain you wish to be here? Silk slithered as her leg thrust through the slit in her skirt, and she stepped from the limousine, Tachyon's hand a steady prop. Are you sure you want to be here? You're the one who got his face danced on. A dismissing gesture with one small hand. It's nothing. And I would not like to disappoint Hiram after he was so obliging as to rescue us. Okay. But you've had a very terrifying experience, and I wouldn't want... Doctor, we're here now, and I really don't see what's to be gained by continuing to discuss the matter on the sidewalk in front of several hundred gawking tourists. She swept through the front doors of the Empire State Building, thoroughly bored and thoroughly irritated by his harping. Tachyon had been concerned while he dressed for dinner, attentive when they'd returned to her apartment, so she could change from her neat slacks into the white silk evening gown she now wore. Solicitous as they drove, and she was ready to kill him. And the irony was not lost on her, for even as he had fussed and cosseted, all her thoughts were obsessed with the fact that he yet lived. She had spent 8 hours in his company, helped rescue him from kidnappers, and still hadn't killed him. Later, there is still time. The lobby was crowded with reporters. They lay like a seething lake before the elevators, and when Tachyon entered, they become a tsunami rushing forward to accost him. Microphones thrust rapier-like into their faces, a babble of overlapping questions. Any comment on the death of Kid Dinosaur and the Howler? Are you working with the authorities on this case? What's this about you being kidnapped? Blended with the whine of high-powered cameras. Tachyon, looking thunderous, waved them away, and when that failed, shouldered through them toward the express elevator. A handsome man in a rumpled gray suit pushed up close to Roulette, and she shied back. Hey, Tacky, giving our eyes a rest, or what? Or just trying to match your lady love? The reporter's eye swept ironically across the white breeches, tunic and cloak and white boots, the heels inset with moonstones, and ended on the small white velvet hat with a moonstone and silver brooch pinned to its upturned brim. Digger, step aside. Who's the new ace? Hey, babe, what's your power? I'm not an ace, let me be. Agitation made her breath ragged, and she looked away from those two piercing eyes. Tachyon, Digger said, tone suddenly very serious. May I speak with you? Not now, Digger. It's important. Tachyon, please get me out of this crowd. Her fingers plucked at his sleeve, and he pulled his attention from the journalist. See me at my office. The elevator doors sighed closed behind them, and her heart began to slow. I've never known Digger to be wrong. Are you quite sure? I am not an ace. She jerked his hand from her bare shoulder. How many times do I have to tell you? I'm sorry. His tone was low, the hurt evident in his lilac eyes. Don't! Don't be sorry, don't be solicitous, don't care! He moved to the far side of the elevator, and they completed the ride in silence. The elevator deposited them in the large outer lobby of Aces High. Roulette glanced about, curiosity submerging agitation. She had never been to the restaurant. Josiah had considered the entire Ace/Joker phenomenon vulgar and more than a little frightening. Witness his response when he discovered that he too carried the alien virus and had avoided this Ace Mecca. Celebrity photographs lined the walls, and in the center of the room stood Hiram, smiling, urbane, polite, but implacable in his refusal to allow the tall scarecrow figure in the purple Uncle Sam suit to enter his restaurant. "But I'm like a friend of Starshine's," the gangling blonde hippie was protesting. "And Jumpin' Jack Flash, too, man." "I'm sure you are," Hiram said. He went on to gently explain that well-known Aces had a great many friends, far more than the restaurant's seating capacity. And while Aces High would be delighted to have the captain's patronage on any other night of the year, tonight was a private party. He was sure that the captain would understand. Tachyon grasped the situation in an instant and put a hand on Hiram's broad shoulder. "I know what it looks like," he said. "But Captain Trips really is an ace, and a good man, too. I'll vouch for him, Hiram." Hiram looked surprised, then relented. "Well, of course, if you say so, Doctor." He turned to Trips. "Please accept my apologies. We get a great many would-be gatecrashers and ace groupies, often wearing outlandish costumes. So when someone cannot demonstrate an ace talent, we... I'm sure you understand." "Yeah, sure, man," Tripp said. "It's cool. Thanks, Doc." He put on his hat and entered the restaurant.
"Just because you're wearing a mask doesn't mean you can just waltz in here, lady," the big man wearing a tuxedo in the foyer of Aces High told Jennifer. She smiled at him, ghosted her arm, and put it through the wall. She wanted to do something more box office, like sink through the floor, but didn't want to have to dress again in front of all the people waiting to enter the restaurant. "Yeah, okay." The man in the tuxedo waved her in, looking faintly bored. Aces High was a dream. Jennifer felt small, insignificant, and decidedly underdressed. She wished that Brennan had brought her an evening gown rather than jeans, but realized with a sigh that that would have required supernatural foresight on Brennan's part. There were over 100 people in the main dining area, drinking cocktails, nibbling on delicious-looking hors d'oeuvres, and talking in small groups and large parties. Jennifer headed for the buffet table, her stomach rumbling at the sight of so much food. There was pâté de foie gras, caviar, slices of Danish ham, 12 kinds of cheese, and a half dozen varieties of bread and crackers. She spread pâté on a cracker and looked around the room, feeling like a celebrity hound as she watched scores of famous people pass by her. Hiram Worcester, fat man, looked harried, probably the strain of orchestrating the dinner, Jennifer thought. She recognized Fortunato, even though he was an ace who had never sought publicity. He was talking to Peregrine. He looked earnest. She looked amused. She felt the playing card that she'd tucked into her back pocket, but was hesitant to go up to him and present it. It looked like he had his own worries, and besides, she could take care of herself. She snagged a glass of champagne from a tray of a waiter circulating around the room and drained it, washing down pâté de foie gras and cracker.
"I knew it! I just knew it!"
The voice was masculine and drawling, with an undercurrent of excitement in it.
"I just knew she'd show up here."
Jennifer turned, champagne glass in one hand and half a cracker smeared with pâté in the other. Hiram was standing behind her. With him was the man she had seen get out of the cab, the man in the white battle suit. "Are you talking to me?"
"You bet your sweet butt, honey," the man in white said.
There was something wrong with his face.
He looked her over with an annoying intentness that made Jennifer feel naked, but that was only part of what made Jennifer feel uncomfortable. His features, individually, were all right, perhaps even handsome, but taken together were utterly unmatched. His nose was too long, his chin too small. One of his intense green eyes was higher than the other. His jaw was canted, as if it had been broken and then healed crookedly. He licked his lips in an agitated, excited manner. Hiram sighed.
"Are you sure, Mr. Ray?" "She's the one. I know she is. I knew she couldn't stay away from this goddamn party. Damn if I wasn't right."
"Very well, then, do your duty." He sighed again and made ringing motions with his hands as if he were washing them of the matter. The man he called Ray nodded, then turned to Jennifer.
"My name's Billy Ray. I'm a federal agent, and I'd like to see some ID.
"Why?" Jennifer asked with a sinking feeling.
"You look like someone who robbed the home of a prominent citizen this morning."
Jennifer looked at the fragment of cracker she still held in her hand. She hadn't even begun to take the edge off her appetite. "Damn," she said, and the cracker and champagne glass slipped through her hands as she ghosted through the floor. Ray moved like a cat on speed. He leaped upon her, but only grasped her shirt, which was crumpling to the floor.
"Ah, Jesus, Worcester!"
Jennifer heard him say before she slipped entirely through the floor.
"You should have let me cold cock the bitch."
Tachyon's small form had vanished into the milling aces in search of alcohol. Alcohol she badly needed. The rumble of voices, the tinkle of ice and crystal glasses, and the energetic efforts of a small combo all combined to form a drill that was digging ever deeper into her head. Ice sculptures of various of the more prominent aces dotted the room. Peregrine had taken up a position near her statue, and her beautiful wings threatened to overset the frozen replica. Captain Trips, a glass of fruit juice clutched in a bony hand, tried to negotiate the room, but his amazing stovepipe hat kept tumbling to the floor. The Harlem Hammer, looking decidedly uncomfortable in his best suit, retrieved the hat. The contrast between the immensely powerful Black Ace, his bald pate shining under the lights, and the weedy captain was startling. The professor, an ice-blue Sybil, lounged near the bar. Sybil, with her blue, sexless, naked body, could have doubled for one of the ice sculptures. She even gave up a faint chill to those standing near her. Her companion created a stir by his own peculiar sense of style. With his whiskers, balding head, wire-rimmed spectacles, and belching pipe, he looked like someone's kindly old uncle. But no uncle of roulette's would ever have worn a sky-blue tux with scuff sandals. Fantasy, the ABT's prima ballerina and one of New York's more public aces, waved a rose before Pit Boss's nose while Trump Card looked on indulgently. "So many. And which of you will survive this night?" "Not many, I think, with my master seeking you."
The problem with being a genial host was the necessity to be polite to boors. Hiram sipped at the champagne glass full of Werner's ginger ale. He liked to have a drink in hand to promote the atmosphere of conviviality, but he had too many responsibilities to allow himself to get tipsy, and tried to feign a great interest in what Captain Trips was saying.
"I mean, it's like elitist, man. This whole dinner on a day like this, it ought to be aces and jokers all getting together like for brotherhood,"
the gangling hippie with the long blonde hair and weedy goatee told him. The Aces High staff had barred a dozen groupies and pretenders, including the fish woman with her bowl of telepathic goldfish, an elderly gentleman in a cape who time-traveled in his sleep, and a 200-pound teenage girl who wore only pasties and a G-string and claimed to be immortal. That one was tough to disprove, admittedly, but Hiram had turned her away nonetheless. He found himself wishing he'd been similarly resolute with Trips, whose powers seemed equally elusive, if in fact he had any at all. If only Dr. Tachyon had not arrived just when he did. Hiram sighed. It was spilt milk now,
He'd admitted the captain, and a few minutes later, while making his rounds of the party, mingling and smiling, he'd made a second mistake and asked Trips how he was enjoying himself. Since then, he'd been trapped by the ice sculpture of Peregrine, while the tall man in the purple Uncle Sam suit explained earnestly that, like alcohol was poison, man, and you really ought to be serving some tofu and sprouts because the body is like a temple, you know, and wasn't the whole idea of the wild card dinner like, politically incorrect? It was no wonder Dr. Tachyon had vouched for him, Hiram thought, gazing at Trips's prominent Adam's apple and purple top hat. They obviously shopped at the same boutique. Hiram's smile was so frozen he hoped that frost wasn't forming in his beard. His attention wandered across the room, and he noticed a number of diners taking their drinks out onto the balcony, where the sun was sinking behind New Jersey, turning the sky a deep, robust red. That gave Hiram an inspiration. "It looks to be a magnificent sunset tonight, Captain," he said. "That's a sight you really shouldn't miss, since you don't get to visit us too often. Sunset from Aces High is quite special, I'm sure you'll agree. Quite far out?" It worked. Captain Trips craned his head around, nodded, and started to take a step toward the balcony. But somehow those long pipe-stem legs managed to get tangled up in each other, and he started to trip. Before Hiram could step forward and catch him, Trips had thrown out a hand to steady himself, grabbed hold of the ice sculpture, snapped off the end of Peregrine's wing, and fallen flat on his face. His hat flew 10 feet and landed at the feet of the Harlem Hammer, who picked it up with a look of disgust, carried it back to Trips, and pulled it down firmly onto the captain's head. By then, Captain Trips had gotten to his feet, an icy wingtip still in his hand. He looked very abashed.
I'm sorry, man, he managed.
He tried to fit the missing piece back on the end of Perry's wing.
I'm real sorry, it was beautiful, man, he said. Maybe I can fix it.
Hiram took the ice away from him and gently turned him around. Never mind, he said. Just go watch the sunset.
Jack leaned heavily against Vagabond as they came up out of the subway. Rosemary followed, scrutinizing the crowd. She took Jack's free arm tightly, lending support as the trio negotiated 23rd Street toward the Haiphong Lily. No one paid any heed to them as the three moved slowly down the sidewalk. In here. Vagabond steered them into a dark, narrow courtyard, ill-lit by two flickering streetlights on the block. I smell something good, Jack said miserably, raising his head. Rosemary, this is your scene. Vagabond helped Jack support himself against a bent steel railing leading up to a long, unrestored brownstone. She turned back toward the assistant district attorney. How do you want to play it? Rosemary peered down the street toward the next dim pool of light. What I want to do is use the notebooks to exert some control on the Gambiones. From there, maybe I can reach the rest of the families. The regret was evident both in her look and in her voice. Sorry to put you through this, Jack, but unless we de-escalate this war among the crime powers, the city will be in a state of siege. Her voice firmed. By holding onto the books and releasing just enough information to maintain the balance, I want to influence the selection of the new Don and his attitude toward the families and the new gangs. Piece of cake, Jack said through gritted teeth. You really believe you can do that? Vagabond was unconvinced that Rosemary could carry off the far-fetched plan. Hell of a nice speech, said Jack. Rosa Maria Gambione can do that. Rosemary faced Vagabond. But what will they do when they find out who the assistant DA really is? Vagabond frowned at the other woman. You might as well step in front of an IRT. It's my choice. It's my heritage. She shrugged eloquently. How else will I be able to make up for my father's acts? 100 Hail Marys, Jack said, weaving slightly. Sorry about that. Your father chose to be what he was. You are not guilty of his sins. Vagabond grasped Rosemary's upper arm hard enough to hurt. Your responsibility is to yourself. I don't see it that way. She pried Vagabond's hand from her arm and held it for a moment. What I don't like is putting you and Jack into danger. Hey, we're used to it. We're aces, right? Vagabond looked at Jack, who was swearing softly in French. Even in the poor light, they could see his skin starting to turn gray. How much longer? Jack said. Just give it a little more time, Rosemary said reassuringly. Yeah, sure, Jack winced. Damn, it hurts.
He froze when he saw the limos parked in front. Spectre took a deep breath and a moment to calm himself. It wasn't the astronomer. Couldn't be, not yet. What did he expect mafiosi to arrive in? Hondas and Yugos? He saw the neon lily and knew he was in the right place. He stepped inside and walked up the creaky wooden stairs. A large man blocked his way at the top. The goon was over 6 feet high and built like a defensive lineman, obviously mob muscle. He would have been nothing more than a side of beef to Spectre, except that he wore mirrored sunglasses.
"Reservations?" he asked, like it was the only word of English he knew.
"Yeah," Spectre tried to slide past, but the man grabbed his bad wrist.
"Hold on."
Spectre gritted his teeth. "You got some kind of problem."
"We got a private party here tonight."
"Excuse me." An Oriental man put a hand on the hard muscle's shoulder. He looked at Spectre, the corners of his mouth twitching slightly. "This gentleman is not with your party, but he does have a reservation."
"Will he stand for a frisk?"
The big man addressed the question to the Oriental, then looked over at Spectre.
"No problem."
Spectre unbuttoned his coat and raised his arms. The man frisked him in a quick, professional manner.
"You Secret Service or something?" Spectre asked. "Okay, do what you want with him."
The big man took a step back toward the stairs. The Oriental, Spectre figured him for a manager, hustled him to a table near the entrance to the private room. He handed Spectre a menu and smiled weakly.
"No trouble," he whispered. "They told me there would be no trouble."
"Only if the food's bad."
"Food is excellent."
The manager signaled a waiter and turned away, seeming relieved. The menu was hand-printed in gold and silver and some kind of fancy card stock, not laminated like he was used to. Spectre opened it and sighed. Bad to worse. Not only was everything written in Vietnamese, but there were no numbers next to the entrees. It would be hard enough trying to find something edible without having to pronounce it, too.
"Excuse me, sir. Would you like some tea?"
Spectre looked up at the waiter.
"Sure.
A little caffeine would be good for his reflexes when the time came." The waiter turned over his cup with a white-gloved hand and filled it.
"Would you like a few more minutes before you order?"
"Yeah. Come back in a while." The waiter nodded, set the white china teapot on the table, and walked away. Spectre picked up the cup and blew the steam away from the surface of the tea. It looked a little greener than what he was used to. He took a tentative sip. The tea was almost too hot to be drinkable, but it was strong enough to do the job. He let it cool for a few minutes, and then put away as much as he could. Spectre smelled meat and vegetables cooking in hot oil. His stomach burned. He needed to get something solid into it soon. Two people entered the restaurant. One was young. The other had to be pushing 70. Both were wearing dark suits and hats. They talked briefly to the guard at the door, then disappeared into the private room. Spectre could hear their voices, but wasn't able to pick out enough words to follow the conversation. It didn't really matter. Most of them would be sleeping with the fishes before too much longer. He turned back to the menu. If he ordered a beef dish, he could at least eat the meat. Another group walked past the guard, into the meeting room. "Hello," he thought. "I'm Demise. I'll be killing your asses stone-cold dead tonight." His waiter wandered back over.
"You ready now, sir?"
"Yes, I'd like something with beef in it. You understand. Plenty of hot stuff, too." The waiter nodded and left. Spectre checked his watch. 7:45. He picked up his cup and sipped at the tea.
when he was sure everyone was there, he'd make his move.
The cocktail hour was drawing to a close, and Curtis and his attentive staff were beginning to escort the guests to their tables when Jay Aykroyd finally showed up with Chrysalis on his arm. Poppin' Jay was in the same brown suit and loafers that he'd worn all day, tieless and a little rumpled. Chrysalis was wearing a glittering, floor-length gown of metallic silver. It covered both breasts and one shoulder, but the slit up the side was high enough to make it perfectly apparent that she had decided to do without underwear. Her long legs flashed as she strode across the floor, muscles moving like smoke beneath transparent skin, the eyes in her skeletal face scanning the room as if she owned it. Hiram met them by the bar. "Jay is as tardy as ever," he said. "I really ought to take him to task for delaying our meeting. I'm Hiram Worcester." He kissed her hand. She seemed amused. "I'd guessed as much," she said in cultivated public school tones. "You're British," Hiram said with a delighted smile. "My father was British. He fought at Dunkirk, you know. A male war bride, but not the kind who wore white." Chrysalis smiled politely. Ackroyd's smile was more cynical. "You two probably want to talk about Winston Churchill or Yorkshire pudding or something. I think I'll get a drink." "Do that," Hiram said. Jay took the hint and wandered off to chat with Wallwalker. "I believe you have some information for me," Hiram said to Chrysalis. "I might," she said. She glanced around. In a room full of celebrities and attractive women, she was drawing more than her share of glances. "Here? Seems rather public." "In my office," Hiram said. When the door was shut behind them, Hiram sank gratefully into a chair and gestured her to a seat. "May I?" she asked, producing a cigarette from a small handbag. He nodded, she lit up, and Hiram watched the smoke swirl inside her nasal cavities when she inhaled. "Let's dispense with the foreplay," Chrysalis suggested. "The sort of information you want is dangerous and expensive. How much are you prepared to spend?" Hiram slid open his drawer, took out a ledger-sized checkbook, and began to fill out a check. She watched him carefully. He ripped it out and slid it across the desk. Chrysalis leaned forward, picked up the check, looked at it. The ghostly musculature of her face worked as she raised an eyebrow. She folded the check in half and tucked it into her handbag. "Very good. That buys you a lot, Mr. Worcester. Not all, but a lot." "Go on." He folded his hands on the desk. "You told Jay that Bludgeon was a part of something bigger." "What?" "Call them the Shadow Fist Society," Chrysalis said. "That's the name you hear on the street. It's as good as any other. It's a large and powerful criminal organization, Mr. Worcester, made up of many lesser gangs. The Immaculate Egrets in Chinatown, the Werewolves in Jokertown, Bludgeon's motley group along the waterfront, and a dozen others. They have allies in Harlem, Hell's Kitchen, Brooklyn, all over the city." "The Syndicate," Hiram said. "Don't confuse them with the Mafia. The Shadow Fist Society is waging a very quiet war against the Mafia, in fact, and it is winning. It has fingers in a good number of pies, everything from drugs to prostitution to the numbers, as well as some legitimate businesses. Bludgeon and his protection racket are one of the smallest and least significant parts of this operation, but a part nonetheless. If I were you, I'd be very careful. Bludgeon himself is cheap muscle, but his sponsors are ruthless and efficient people who brook no interference. If you annoy them, they'll kill you as easily as you might swat a fly." Hiram made a fist. "They might find that difficult." "Because you're an ace," she smiled. "On a day like today, that seems precious little to cling to, dear boy. Do you remember that rather sensational gangland murder on Staten Island last year? It was in all the papers." Hiram frowned. "One of those Ace of Spades killings, wasn't it? I vaguely recall seeing the headlines. What was it the victim called himself?" "Scar," said Chrysalis. "An instantaneous teleport and a Shadow Fist hitman. Well, he's done. But they have other aces working for them, if rumors can be believed, with powers as potent as his, maybe as many as a dozen. You'll hear names. Fadeout, the Whisperer, Worm. For all you know, one of your guests out there might be a Shadow Fist, sipping your champagne while he ponders the best way to dispose of you." Hiram considered a moment.
Can you tell me the name of the man at the top of this organization? I could, Chrysalis said coolly, but passing along information like that could get me killed. Not that I wouldn't risk it for the right price, of course, she laughed. I just don't think you have that much money, Mr. Worcester. Suppose I wanted to talk to them, he said. She shrugged. Unless you can provide me with a name, you'll find I can easily stop payment on that check. We can't have that, she said. Are you familiar with the name Latham Strauss? The law firm, Hiram said. Attorneys from Latham Strauss pried Bludgeon loose this afternoon after Jay had teleported him into the tombs. I had cause to ask a few questions about that firm today, and I discovered that the senior partner habitually takes a keen interest in men like Bludgeon. That seems strange, since his personal clients include a number of the city's richest and most powerful men, a few of whom have good reasons to be discreet. Do you understand what I'm telling you? Hiram nodded. Do you have his address? She opened her handbag and produced it. Hiram's respect for her rose a notch. I'll give you one more bit of advice for free, she added. And what is that? Chrysalis smiled. Don't call him Loophole, she said. Chapter 15. 8 p.m. It had become something of a ritual the way these dinners began. When the rest of them were all seated, when the waiters had brought the soup and the diners had chosen their entrees, then all eyes went to Hiram Worcester. He filled a tall, thin glass with champagne, made himself light, lighter than air, and floated gently up to the high ceiling next to one of his chandeliers. "A toast," he said, raising his glass as he did every year. His deep voice was solemn, sad. "To Jet Boy! To Jet Boy!" they repeated in unison, 100 voices all together, but no one drank. There were more names to come. To Black Eagle, Hiram said. To Braintrust, and to the Envoy wherever he might be. To the Turtle whose voice led us back from the wilderness. Let us all hope that he is safe and sound, that like Mark Twain the reports of his demise have been grossly exaggerated. To all of our brother aces, great and small, living and dead and yet to come. To the jokers and their thousands, and to the memory of the tens of thousands who drew the Black Queen. Hiram paused, looked down on the room silently for a moment, went on. To the Howler, he said, and a laugh that could shatter brick. To Kid Dinosaur, who was never as small as the one who killed him. To the Tarkesians, who cursed us and made us like gods, and to Dr. Tachyon, who helped us in our hour of need. And always, to Jet Boy. To Jet Boy, they repeated once again. This time they drank, and perhaps one or two actually paused for a moment to remember the boy who couldn't die yet, before they lifted soup spoons and began to eat. Hiram Worcester settled slowly back to the floor.
You're not eating, Tachyon remarked gently, sneaking a glance at her almost untouched plate. Neither are you. I have an excuse, which is, my mouth hurts. That's not the real reason. Why should you care to hear the real reason? I don't care. She looked away, but memory formed a transparent picture separating her from the room. Josiah, nostrils tightening fastidiously, superimposed over Trips's kindly face. Her baby lying like some grotesque entree on Mistral's plate. What's your excuse? That I'm going to kill, have to kill, you, and I'm losing my nerve. Would that answer satisfy you? Brain engaged with mouth, and she heard herself say, I'm upset about what happened today. Which part? The alien asked with a grim little smile. The tomb, the killing. His hand covered hers. And you have hit on the reason for my lack of appetite. How can I eat when Kid? I think of his parents. The French onion soup she had eaten earlier in the evening hit the back of her throat, and she swallowed convulsively. Excuse me, she muttered breathlessly, and pushing back her chair fled from the dining room. The curious glances felt like blows. In the bathroom, she sluiced cold water across her face, heedless of her careful makeup job, and rinsed her mouth. It helped but could not relieve the burning knot in the pit of her stomach. Her amber eyes stared bleakly out of the mirror, fawn-wide and as frightened. She studied the perfect oval of her face, the high, chiseled cheekbones, the narrow nose, legacy from some white ancestor. It looked like a normal face. How could it hide such? Her mind rebelled at the word. Not evil. It hid memories. Memories of evil. Whose evil? The man whose kin had brought the hell-born virus to Earth and broken her life? Or her own? She rested her hands on either side of the sink, bent forward, her breath coming in quick gulps. He lives, Roulette. Fear drew a whimper, and she whirled to face him, shrank back as he laid aside a nail file left for the convenience of the female customers of Aces High, inspected knotted veins in the back of his hand, and swiveled slowly on the small dressing table stool to face her. It was an incongruous sight. The astronomer dressed as an Aces High waiter, framed by double rows of theatrical lights, the back of his balding head reflected in the mirror.
Oh my gosh! What are you
doing here? Apparently finishing the business that you have failed to do. Dealing a little in death. I came expecting lamentations, fear and loathing. What do I find? A bunch of aces feeding their faces and talking.
You can't. Not here.
Oh, yes. By all means, here. Starting with Tachyon.
No.
Concern?
He's mine.
Then why haven't you killed him? He had lost the jovial tone, his voice grating like rock across sandpaper. He came off the chair. The action made all the more menacing for its slowness. Her voice didn't work, and she tried again.
I'm toying with him.
What a dramatic, almost melodramatic phrase. Toying with him, he repeated thoughtfully. His hand shot out, caught her by the throat.
Well, don't toy with him. Kill him!
Spittle wetted her cheek, and she twisted in his grasp. The hand tightened, larynx aching under the pressure, blood rushing, beating in her ears. Roulette clawed at his hand, begging for mercy, but only mewling sounds emerged. He threw her contemptuously aside, and she came up hard against the edge of a toilet bowl.
You can't make me. Fear of you won't be enough.
True. I wish you would recognize the wisdom of what I've told you. Only your hate will free you. Only if you release the acid of your soul can you be at peace. She dug her fingers into her temples.
I don't know what I hate worse, your threats or your pop psychology.
He continued as if she hadn't spoken. Only that ultimate catharsis can save you from a lifetime of memory. He tore aside his carefully constructed mental shields, gripped and broke a part of her mind. The pictures fluttered past behind her eyes. Nurse's hand hard on her chest, forcing her back. Don't look. She looked.
Monster!
It lay in an incubator, mewling out its life, hidden away. 4 days of watching it die. Disgust. Becoming love, becoming hate. Nurse's hand hard on her chest, forcing. And so it went, a never-ending replay of a nightmare.
Kill him, and it stops.
Oh, God, I don't believe you. Her fingers writhed in her hair.
That's unfortunate, for you really don't have any other option.
Is it time yet?
Jack raised his head from the steel railing he was clutching. Bagabal moved over to stand beside him. She put her arm around his waist.
Soon. It'll be soon.
She reached up to push the sweat-soaked black hair away from his eyes. Obviously in pain, Jack stared back at her. Shadowed, his dark eyes blended invisibly with the night.
You'll have to go in as yourself, she said. I'll help you change when the time comes. I'll be there with you the whole time.
Bagabon put her hand on top of his on the railing. He turned his hand over and clasped her fingers.
I have a bad feeling about this, Jack said.
He looked down at their plated fingers, but didn't take his hand away.
I wish the cats were here. Me too.
Anything goes wrong, he said. You get out. I mean it. I can take care of myself.
Bagabon said nothing, but squeezed a bit harder. She looked over at Rosemary.
Can we start in?
The lawyer walked back to the corner and peered around the dingy brick. It looked clear. She touched her digital watch, squinting at the dim glow. It's 8:20. Everybody who's coming should have gone in by now. Let's go. The entrance to the Haifeng Lily was marked by a huge water lily limned in red neon. Its buzzing flicker lit the quiet street. Half a dozen limousines were pulled up at the curb outside the restaurant. The uniformed drivers stood in a group at the head of the line, smoking and gossiping like ordinary cabbies. Each car was guarded by one or two unsmiling men. A couple of the guards impassively watched Bagabon and her companions pass, eyes tracking their progress like the sights on an M60 machine gun. All the guards wore black armbands. The cilantro, fish, and hot pepper smells of the Vietnamese cooking engulfed them before they reached the door.
Mon Dieu!
Jack raised his eyes skyward and then looked toward Bagabon.
Can you believe it? Now I'm hungry. We'll eat as soon as we get this over with.
While the entrance was at street level, the restaurant itself was up a flight of stairs. The stairwell was dimly lit, and the red flocked wallpaper absorbed most of that light. In an alcove beside the inner doorway, a big man whose subdued suit matched those of the watchers outside stood gazing down the steps. He had stepped out at the sound of the outside door and now blocked the upstairs landing.
Reservations, he said.
Of course, Rosemary didn't hesitate. Bagabon felt the eyes behind the mirrored sunglasses checking them for the possibility of a threat. The big man shrugged. Apparently satisfied, he stepped back out of the way. He obviously did not recognize Rosemary. Inside the restaurant was more of the dark wallpaper and a nervous, middle-aged Oriental man who greeted them with a sheaf of menus.
Good evening. Three, yes?
He had already started toward one of the many empty tables when Rosemary stopped him.
We're here for the meeting.
The small man halted abruptly. The dining room was nearly deserted. An elderly couple huddled in intimate conversation to one side. Nearer, a tall, gaunt man with a crooked mouth looked up from his meal. He and the Oriental manager exchanged looks. Bagabon thought for an instant that the lone diner looked awfully familiar, but her attention snapped back as Jack stumbled and nearly fell against a bubbling tank of carp. The maitre d' looked distressed. Smiling weakly, he said,
No meeting.
Yes, said Rosemary. There is, in the private room.
No meeting here.
What we have here, Jack said slowly through taut lips, is a failure to communicate.
Rosemary surveyed the room, stopping when she spotted two men in dark blue suits and expensive sunglasses, sitting at separate tables in the back of the room. They, too, wore the armbands of mourning. She addressed the nearer.
Buongiorno.
Adrian, isn't it? Tony Colenza's son?
Lady, you got the wrong person.
The soldier on the right glanced at his companion, who shrugged. Bagabon tightened her hold on Jack, prepared to pull him to cover if shooting started.
Adrian, said Rosemary, we used to play together. You'd kidnap my dolls and hold them for ransom? I'm hurt you don't remember.
The assistant DA had left Bagabon and stood a few feet away from the table and the man she'd addressed. There was no tension in her stance. Head high, arms loose at her sides. Bagabon had watched her once at a trial. Bagabon thought that she herself had never been so self-assured as Rosemary. She was even less certain now that Rosemary really intended to use the book solely as a means to influence the family. There was too much of her father in her still.
Vagabond remembered Rosemary's remark about wishing she had been a son, able to inherit control. Was she about to provide the means for Rosemary to get that control? I told you my name isn't Adrian. Then I guess I'm not Rosa Maria Gambione. The man pulled off his mirror shades. Maria! He smiled for the first time. I remember once I sent you the right hand from a kidnapped doll. You still wouldn't pay. The other man spoke for the first time. Be quiet, Adrian. Rosa Maria Gambione disappeared many years ago. He said to her, You look more like a district attorney to me, Ms. Muldoon. Very good. I don't know you, do I?
No.
My father fought for the family in the old ways. I chose new ones.
Like hounding us, said the second man. Prosecuting us.
To be a useful district attorney, I have to be a good district attorney. The thin, inexpressive mouth below the sunglasses twitched at one corner.
Adrian, get your father. I think he'll be interested in this.
He leaned back in his chair and said,
Please sit down, you and your friends, Ms. Muldoon.
Rosemary pulled out a chair and sat, crossing her legs and smiling at the man on the other side of the table. She barely turned her head. Suzanne, I think now would be an appropriate time. Vagabond turned Jack toward her and extended a hand toward his head. The man pulled back sharply.
Not here. You're right. She caught Rosemary's eye and pointed her chin toward the door of the men's restroom.
Good idea, said Rosemary. To the man across the table, she said, My friends will be rejoining me in just a moment. I can assure you they are not armed. She looked directly into the opaque lenses. Do you have a name?
Okay, make it quick.
He waved idly at the restroom.
You always hang out with junkies?
Rosemary reached across the table and poured herself a cup of tea. No.
Morelli, said the man.
Very pleased to meet you. Vagabond led Jack to the men's room door.
Perhaps I'd best go first.
Jack reached out to steady himself against the doorframe.
You won't make it, Vagabond said matter-of-factly. Your face is touching.
Then he gasped in pain.
On the other hand...
Vagabond pulled open the door and walked in. No one stood at the urinal, but a Vietnamese man dressed in a soiled kitchen apron was just coming out of the stall. He squawked in surprise, managed hurriedly to wash his hands, then left, muttering in a language Vagabond was glad she didn't understand.
Get in here, she said to Jack. The door swung shut after him. I don't know if I can do this, said Jack. Sometimes I can't call him up. I hurt too much right now to concentrate. Just take off your clothes.
What?
He tried to smile. Vagabond, this isn't the time.
He shut up as she stared at him in exasperation.
I don't have any spare clothing for you this time. If you don't take it off, you're going to destroy what you've got on, okay?
Oh, right.
His back to her, Jack unbuttoned his shirt. Careless of her suit, Vagabond sat down on the dirty tile floor. After he had stripped, Jack looked dubiously at her. He held the bundle of clothes in front of him.
Lie down.
Jack swallowed and prostrated himself in front of Vagabond. In the limited space, his feet extended under the green wooden partition dividing off the stall. She reached out and set his clothing safely aside. Holding his head in her hands, she began to send her consciousness inside his mind, searching for the key to his transformation.
Let go of the pain. Stop trying to control it.
Vagabond stopped using the rough voice she had adopted years before. Now she spoke in the rhythm she used when she calmed her animals. She synchronized her breathing with that rhythm and stroked Jack's head. She knew the way. It was not the first time she had worked with Jack, although it was the first time she had sought to release the beast rather than contain it. Jack relaxed under her hands. In his mind, he led her down through the levels of his consciousness. She dodged the barriers there and respected the private self which stood behind them. The cats had always urged her to pry. Out of friendship and because of her own near-pathological desire for privacy, Vagabond resisted that severe temptation. Journeying through Jack's mind was a trip defined by smell. The city, its people, Vagabond herself, were all denoted by their individual scents, not by sight or words. Those came much later in the chain of consciousness. Coming to a smell of swamp, rotting death and decay and darkness, Jack stopped. Vagabond met his fear of never returning from the swamp with her reassuring consciousness. She was there. She would not abandon him. But it was the strength of her will that forced him back through the dark space and smell that lay at the core of his reptile self. As Jack's conscious mind was subsumed into the other, Vagabond fled back through his brain as it imploded into the reptile consciousness. The miasma of the swamp and the bellowing challenge of a bull alligator followed her like a riptide. As she returned to her own body, the reaction flung Vagabond's head back against the side of the porcelain sink and jerked her hands away from the alligator, whose head lay heavily in her lap. The reptile flipped over onto his feet again and roared the challenge Vagabond had just heard. Gasping quick, deep lungfuls of air, she entered the creature's mind and calmed him. Tail tip twitching, he backed slightly away from her, cramped for space in the small restroom. Vagabond looked up when she heard Rosemary's voice raised outside. The restroom door opened sufficiently to reveal the worried face of the Vietnamese maitre d'. His eyes widened and his hand rose to his mouth before slamming the door on the impossible scene. She looked back down at the alligator and began to search through his mind for the trigger to force him to vomit up the books. Vagabond directed the alligator toward the stall as she uncovered the memory of poisoned meat. The psychic feedback almost did the trick for her, too. The alligator vomited the contents of his gullet onto the floor and into the stool. The stench of half-digested foods shook even Vagabond, inured to most aspects of life and death. Calming the agitated reptile, she got up and gingerly fished for the plastic-wrapped books. Thankfully, it didn't take long. She rinsed off the package in the sink. The alligator whipped his tail, smashing the stall partition into kindling. He growled deep in his throat, a discontented, hungry rumbling. Reaching out to the alligator brain, Vagabond began the process of separating Jack's humanity from the reptile mind. In little more than a minute, Jack lay shivering on the cold tile where the gator had been. She handed him his clothes as he curled up fetally against the smell and the memory. It had to be done. She moistened a paper towel and gently wiped his forehead. Each time I think I will never be human again. Jack stared at the wall. When that finally happens, perhaps it will be for the best. Not for Cordelia, nor herself, but that thought remained unspoken. Cordelia, yeah, okay. His voice was flat. Let's get this thing done. Dressed now, he pushed open the door. Vagabond followed him. Across the room, Rosemary stood with two older men who had joined the group.
Rosa Maria, we have only the greatest respect for your late father, but we cannot allow you to interfere with the business of the family.
The taller man spread his hands and regarded her paternally. The family business is my business. Rosemary glanced over at the approaching Vagabond and Jack. I am a Gambioni. She took the slightly damp packet that Vagabond handed her. The two older mafiosi exchanged exasperated looks. It was obvious to Vagabond that this conversation had been going on for some time while she'd been in the restroom. I have a proposition for the family, said Rosemary. She held the books upright on the table, leaning on them slightly as she spoke. All the capos should hear me. The taller man said,
You are a woman. Roberto, let us speak. We must make decisions, and this is delaying us.
The smaller, heavyset capo touched his companion's arm. Resignedly, the other man nodded. Morelli opened the door. Rosemary started in, followed by Vagabond and Jack. Morelli held out his hand to bar Rosemary's companions. She stared at the capos until they nodded. Morelli dropped his hand in a gesture for them to enter. The private dining room was long and narrow, almost filled by the single table surrounded by the capos of the family. They were angrily debating the proper method of exacting retribution for Don Federico's death. The black crepe bands were ubiquitous. Halfway down the white linen table, one man stood listening to the discussion around him. He raised his eyes as Rosemary, Vagabond, and Jack entered.
These are the people with the notebooks?
Yes, Don Tomaso,
said the tall capo who had questioned them outside. Rosemary moved to the near end of the table. Without releasing the books, she placed them on the tablecloth.
Vagabond stood beside her. Jack wandered to the far end of the room and peered out the window at the dark alley.
Thank you, Rosa Maria.
Don Tomaso's voice held an oily, unctuous tone.
Thank you for bringing these to us.
Vagabond tensed and narrowed her eyes. This was one human she knew she especially did not like. Should it become necessary, his throat would be the one she'd spring at. She wrinkled her nose. The aroma of fish sauce made her realize she was hungry, too. Signorina Gambioni, if you please, Don Tomaso. Rosemary's fingers tightened on the books. She met his gaze across the table. Vagabond sensed the growing tension on both sides and felt her muscles echo the tautness. A garbage truck's hydraulic whine and the crash of an upturned dumpster came from outside. The moment of silence in the dining room stretched. It was Don Tomaso who finally inclined his head in acquiescence. The books are not a gift, said Rosemary. They're mine. I decide who has access to their information.
Then you speak as one outside the family.
Don Tomaso shifted his eyes toward a man to his right. Vagabond followed the slight motion. She again wished she had the claws and teeth of the cats. I speak as one who has seen the near destruction of the Gambioni family. We are threatened on all sides, yet you sit here debating revenge upon an enemy you cannot even name. Rosemary surveyed the room angrily and shook the books at Tomaso. If you follow the ways of the butcher, the Gambiones are doomed. Behind them, there was a cry of pain and the door crashed open.
Uh-oh, said Jack.
As Vagabond reached for Rosemary, she was shoved to the floor by the thin diner who'd burst into the room. He was fast. The gaunt man grabbed the books from Rosemary, tripping her as he sped past.
Stop or die!
It was Don Tomaso. As Vagabond struggled to catch Rosemary, she saw Don Tomaso draw a well-polished Beretta and aim at the fleeing thief. To her amazement, the man laughed hoarsely and halted. Mouth-twisting, he turned and stared at the Don, who convulsively fired once and then plunged heavily to the tabletop. It was a signal for the stunned capos to fire at the thief, who was now moving toward the window. The impact of the shots seemed barely to slow him down. Capos who tried to intercept him fell before his gaze as though their bullets were being deflected.
Jack, move! Now!
But even as Vagabond shouted her warning, she saw Jack face the killer. As the man caught Jack's eyes, the shape-changer's face grew scaly and the snout extended, teeth sharp and prominent. For an instant, the thief hesitated, allowing the capo's bullets to slam into him. Then he attempted to bound over the giant alligator that now barred his path to the window. As he leaped, the alligator's head swiveled up and clashed jagged-toothed jaws on the killer's foot. Screaming in shock and pain, the man pinwheeled in midair, blood spraying into the room from his truncated ankle. He crashed through the glass backward, still clutching the books to his chest as he curled up like a wounded snake. Outside, there was a thud and the groaning of transmission gears. The mafiosi ran to the window and fired futile shots after the accelerating garbage truck.
Bastard fell right into the truck!
The shooter at the window turned back to the room.
Don Tomaso, what do we do now?
He set off in the direction of the dead man. The corpse said nothing. The shooter did a little dance to avoid the alligator, which rumbled and swallowed contentedly.
Hiram had shifted a few guests around to make room for the refugees at his own table. With Water Lily on his left, Peregrine on his right, and Beef Wellington, Potatoes Hiram, White Asparagus, and Baby Carrots in front of him, it was a delightful meal. Tuna? Jane said in amazement. This is tuna? Not merely tuna, Hiram said. White meat albacore flown in direct from the Pacific. No doubt she'd just eaten more than her share of chunk light meat out of cans. Tuna casserole, tuna surprise, tuna croquettes. He shuddered inwardly and covered another roll with butter. Food always made him feel better, even when the circumstances were dire. The thoughts of danger, death, and violence had receded into memory, smoothed away by fine wine, beautiful women, and an excellent hollandaise. Behind their table, the doors to the balcony were wide open, and a cool evening breeze moved through Aces High, perhaps gentled by Mistral's invisible hand. Well, Water Lily said, this is wonderful. Thank you, Hiram said.
She was bright, no doubt of it, but her innocence was astonishing. She had a great deal to learn about the world, this Jane Lillian Dow, but he suspected she would be a quick and enthusiastic student. He found himself wondering if she were a virgin. "You're no New Yorker," Peregrine said to Waterlily. "Why do you say that?" She looked bewildered. "Native would never say Hiram's food was wonderful. That's to be expected, after all. New Yorkers are more sophisticated than anyone on earth, so they have to find something to dislike. That way they get to complain and demonstrate their sophistication. Like this." Peregrine turned to Hiram and said, "I enjoyed the vicious soise, really I did, but it just wasn't quite up to Parisian standards. But you know that, I'm sure." Hiram glanced over at Jane, who looked as if she were afraid she'd committed some faux pas. "Don't let yourself be corrupted," he told her with a smile. "I remember when Perry first came to town. Well, that was before the fashion shows and the perfume and Peregrine's perch, before she had her name changed, even before the Playboy centerfold. She was a 16-year-old from... where was it, Perry? Old Dimebox, Texas?" Peregrine grinned at him, saying nothing, and Hiram went on. "The flying cheerleader, that was what the press called her. They were having a national cheerleading competition in Madison Square Garden, would you believe it? Perry was so sophisticated she missed the finals. She decided to save a little money by flying there instead of taking a cab, you see." "What happened?" Waterlily asked. "I had a street map," Peregrine said amiably, "but I was too shy to ask directions. I didn't think I'd be able to miss a big place like Madison Square Garden. I must have flown over Madison Square 100 times searching for it." She turned and raised an eyebrow, and her gorgeous wings stirred the air behind her. "You win, Hiram," she said. "The food is wonderful, as ever." "Flying must be wonderful, too," Jane said with a glance at Peregrine's wings. "It's the second best feeling there is," Peregrine said quickly. "And afterward, you never have to change the sheets." It was said glibly. A familiar answer to a question she'd been asked 1,000 times before. The rest of the table laughed. Jane looked slightly taken aback. Perhaps she'd expected something other than Peregrine's offhand wit, Hiram thought. She looked so fresh and young and lovely in the gown he had bought for her. No, loaned her, he corrected himself, because that was so important to her. He leaned forward, put his hand lightly on her bare arm. "I can teach you to fly," he said quietly. He could not give her true flight, of course. It was more a matter of floating, but no one had ever complained. How many men could make their lovers as light as a feather, or lighter than air itself? Waterlily looked up at him, startled and beautiful, and drew back a little. Her eyes seemed to search him for something, and he wondered what it was. "What do you look for, Waterlily?" he thought, as tiny droplets of moisture began to beat on her smooth, cool skin.
The raw nerve endings from his severed foot screamed white hot into his mind. It was even worse than his death pain, which, after months of living with it, he could now manage to keep humming along in the back of his mind, until he needed it. Luckily, Spectre had stopped bleeding almost immediately. He hoped that damn fucking animal choked on it. Pain lanced through his leg every time the truck hit a bump or pothole. He shoved the notebooks into the front of his pants. They were his now. He could name his own price. He hurt too much to read them, even if the light was good, which it wasn't. Maybe it was just as well he couldn't, though. He'd had more trouble than he could handle in a single day. The truck slowed to a stop. Spectre tried to crawl through the garbage toward the edge. No good. His stump hurt like hell every time he so much as twitched. He heard the hydraulic arm start and looked up. The dumpster went up and over, dropping several 100 pounds of refuse on him. Spectre took a deep breath before he was completely covered. Something heavy landed on his raw ankle. He tried to ignore the pain and claw his way up to the top, but suddenly felt himself moving backward. Bottles, cartons, paper, chicken bones, half-eaten TV dinners, all being compacted together and into him.
He folded up with the garbage and tried to tuck his stump under his other leg. The pressure stopped. He heard the crash of the dumpster being set back down. The truck lurched and began moving again. "Fuck," he said, and was rewarded with a mouthful of soggy coffee grounds. He dug frantically through the garbage toward the open air, trying to ignore the pain. He hoped the truck didn't have any more stops before heading to the dump. Chapter 16. 9 p.m. He was too exhausted to try crawling out of the truck. Regenerating was taking all his energy. Spectre lay atop the garbage as the vehicle bounced down the street. He looked down at his bad foot. Flesh was sticking out several inches beyond the ragged edge of his pants leg. He was growing a new foot. Nothing like this had ever happened before, and he'd been figuring he'd have to get some kind of prosthetic foot. His regenerating ability was even more powerful than he'd dreamed. His system was taking tissue from the rest of his body to build the new foot. No wonder he was so exhausted. It itched like hell. He shoved his hands in his pockets to keep from scratching it. He watched the buildings roll by and tried to figure out where he was. Dock area, maybe. There was some traffic, but the truck was still making pretty good time. He pulled the plastic-wrapped notebooks out of his pants. He couldn't see much while the truck was moving. The illumination from the streetlights was too irregular. Lucky he'd heard the girl talking about them. They'd better be the right ones after all the grief they'd cost him. No way he could have figured on a guy turning into an alligator. All the Aces were supposed to be at Fat Man's for the evening. The truck slowed, and he couldn't see buildings anymore. This was probably the end of the line. He tucked the books away and grabbed the rim of the steel wall with both hands. Spectre pulled and kicked with his good leg. His muscles trembled for a moment, then failed him entirely. He settled back into the garbage, completely drained. The truck stopped. Spectre heard a metal chain being undone and the creak of a gate. He couldn't even manage to sit up. The truck moved slowly forward for a few moments, then stopped again. He knew what was coming next.
"Stop!"
he said. His voice was too weak for the driver to hear. Hydraulic arms lifted the steel box of garbage off the truck and into the air. It began to tilt down. Spectre covered his face and rolled into a ball. He caught his breath as he began to fall and pulled the notebooks to his chest. He landed on his head and shoulders and blacked out.
When the dessert carts started making their stately rounds, Hiram's table was, of course, served first. He was feeling so relaxed and pleased with himself by then that his appetite had quite returned. He accepted a piece of the amaretto cheesecake from one of the new waiters, a wizened little man with a large head and thick glasses. He added a slice of chocolate mango pie for good measure. The cheesecake was up to the lofty Ace's high standards, and the pie was exquisite, its top covered with thin shavings of bittersweet chocolate. Peregrine had chosen the pie as well. Chocolate, she had explained to Waterlily with that famous smile, was the third best thing there was. Jane was staring at the waiter with a strange, blank look on her face.
"Something wrong, dear?" the old man asked her.
She blinked slowly and shook her head, like someone waking from a dream. "No, I mean, I don't remember." She shivered suddenly. "I feel funny."
"Chocolate cures all ills," Peregrine suggested.
But Jane selected the Cherry's Jubilee. Because, she told Hiram and Peregrine with a smile of her own,
"I've heard that when choosing between two evils, you should pick the one you've never tried before."
Hiram found himself laughing out loud at her unexpected Mae West intonations. The wizened little waiter laughed too, a shrill, thin giggle that went on too long,
as if he was amused by some private jest as he wheeled the dessert cart around the table. All around them, attentive waiters were pouring fresh brewed coffee from slender silver pots and setting down little pitchers of heavy cream. Bottles of a delightful sweet wine were opened at tableside for those who cared to imbibe. After dessert, the seats would begin to empty as the guests accepted brandy snifters and tiny glasses of liqueur and began the annual ritual of table hopping. Modular Man had already gotten a head start. The android had bypassed dessert and was field-testing some Courvoisier. Hiram dispatched his desserts in short order, washed them down with just the quickest taste of wine, and pushed back his chair. "Pardon my haste," he said to his dinner companions, who were eating more slowly, savoring every bite. "As the host, I have certain duties, though I hate to leave such delightful company even for an instant." He smiled. "Please don't rush off. The evening is just beginning." Hiram drifted from table to table, smiling at the guests, inquiring about their dinners, accepting the compliments with a gracious smile. Miss Drow, holding court at her table near the balcony doors, said her father would undoubtedly be pleased to know he'd been one of the ice sculptures. "We could hardly leave out Cyclone," Hiram told her, "even if he does miss far too many of these affairs. Living in San Francisco is really no excuse, and you can tell him I said so." Hiram hardly recognized Croyd, who was looking around anxiously for the dessert cart, still two tables away. Next to him, Fortunato sat like a man in a dark shroud and seemed to take no part in the dinner conversation that swirled about him. Hiram considered stopping by the table and giving him a reassuring word, but the look in those dark eyes beneath his massively swollen forehead seemed to forbid it. Cap'n Trips had spilled a cup of herbal tea in the lap of Frank Beaumont's date and was mopping at it ineffectually with a napkin, apologizing profusely, so Hiram was spared the necessity of learning about the dangers of processed sugar. Wall Walker and the Harlem Hammer were talking together intently. When Hiram asked how their dinner had been, a curt nod from the Hammer was all the answer he got. Rada O'Reilly, a petite red-haired lady who had been known to metamorphose into a full-grown Asiatic elephant with a startling capacity for flight, thanked him in a charming Indian accent. Fantasy had deserted the minor playwright who'd accompanied her and was flirting with the professor. Digger Downs had snuck in somehow and was off in a corner by the window interviewing Pulse. Hiram frowned, gave a signal, and two of Peter Chow's security men escorted Digger firmly toward the elevators. A man who could heat a pot of coffee with his bare hands tried to give Hiram a job application and was directed to Chock Full of Nuts. Ladybug reminisced fondly about the year they'd served a gigantic baked Alaska in the shape of Jet Boy's plane. Jay Aykroyd looked as though he was about to rupture and die. "I'll never eat again," he promised solemnly. Hiram dropped down in a vacant chair next to Jay. "Things seem to have gone very well," he said, relieved.
A dessert cart made its way between the tables, but nobody seemed to be in charge of it. Not that it mattered. Fortunato didn't eat sugar, meat, or preservatives if he could help it. It was one of the biggest disappointments the wild card virus had brought him. All his senses had gotten ridiculously sharp. The weird thing was that natural odors, even wet dogs or decaying vegetables, didn't bother him much. It was only the man-made smells, bus exhaust, insecticides, fresh paint, that irritated him. He'd even given up cocaine years ago. Now, when he needed an altered state, he used grass or mushrooms or fresh coca leaves. He'd have preferred an altered state at the moment. Hiram had put him at the same table with Croyd Crenson, which was not itself the problem. Croyd had been a valued customer for years. The problem was Croyd's date. In a masterpiece of bad timing, Ichiko had set Croyd up with Veronica. Veronica smiled and laughed and hardly touched her plate. Fortunato knew her good mood was nothing but bullshit and heroin buzz. He was glad he had both Cordelia and Croyd to separate him from her. She'd ignored him all the way through dinner, and her hand was in Croyd's lap enough that Croyd didn't pay attention to much of anything else, except Cordelia, who'd gotten his attention right away. Croyd was looking good. Thin, tanned, high cheekbones, nice smile lines. Fortunato didn't ask how long Croyd had been awake, but he suspected it was already several days. There was an amphetamine brightness to his eyes. When it played out, he'd sleep for days or weeks and wake up with a new look and a new power. His power this time had something to do with metals. His knife and fork kept going limp in his hands. He would concentrate, and they would stiffen up again. He and Veronica spent a lot of innuendo on the subject, and before long Cordelia had joined in. Fortunato had eaten some of the salad and asparagus and let the rest of it go. "Listen," Croyd said, as a white-jacketed waiter switched his dinner plate for a clean one. "Do you think you could refigure my bill to include this one, too?" He had one arm around Cordelia. "There's a problem there," Fortunato said. "Cordelia isn't on the payroll, at least not yet." "Oh," Croyd said. "I wouldn't want to cut in." "It's not like that," Fortunato said. "You could say we're sort of auditioning one another." Croyd looked embarrassed. "I didn't mean to mistake you for a professional."